You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Takes on the World News.
This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the January 9th, 2009 edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that is now beginning its 19th year on the KZYX and KZYZ airwaves, coming to you live on the second and fourth Wednesdays each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phone to get your takes on the world. Back in 2017, California Democrat Adam Schiff, who now heads the House Intelligence Committee, made headlines by suggesting publicly that what the Donald Trump White House needed was, quote, some adults in the room, unquote, and repeated the suggestion the other day. For Army Major Danny Sherson, it's the adults in the room that are the problem, and he writes, quote, maybe it's time to think of them as the tools of a military-industrial congressional complex that continues to serve up endless war, end quote. At about 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking once again with Major Sherson, an Afghanistan and Iraq war veteran, about his December article on a subject that first appeared on Tom's Dispatch and then was reprinted in The Nation on December 27th, as well as one he wrote yesterday on the tragedy of liberal foreign policy. In the meantime, let's look at some related subjects that have received less than adequate coverage in our national media. Let's start with a part of the first bill of the new congressional session offered by Florida Senator Marco Rubio in the midst of the partial government shutdown. Numbered S1, it appeared intended, noted Time, to drive a wedge between the centrist and liberal Democrats over attitudes toward Israel. The bipartisan package, the creation of Israel's Senate point man, Maryland's Ben Cardin, and backed by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, had reportedly drawn widespread support ahead of Tuesday's vote. Some Democrats are critical over the addition of Rubio's, quote, Combating BDS Act, which would penalize any company or contractor that adhered to the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement targeting Israel, varieties of which have already been approved by 26 states, including California. Incoming Palestinian-American congressional representative from Michigan, Rashida Tlaib, who you may have heard on Democracy Now! Yesterday, upset the Jewish political establishment when she said lawmakers pushing legislation should study the U.S. Constitution and learn about this country's First Amendment rights. This, for her critics, was tantamount to including the legislation's supporters of having dual loyalties, an accusation that would have arguably been justified, but it was not what she had said. But just consider for a moment what it means when on the very first day of a new Senate session, even without a government shutdown, that the first piece of legislation introduced was clearly intended to benefit a foreign country. That's something it'd be worthwhile for Bob Mueller and the Justice Department to investigate. For the moment, amid the partial government shutdown, the package is almost certain to stall, since Democrats say they will block it until government is reopened, as they did yesterday when Rubio introduced it. It seems that even Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, one of Israel's most unabashed supporters in the Senate, opposes acting on the legislation at this point, a senior aide who spoke on conditions of anonymity told Time. Other Democrat senators who also support the bills were apparently following suit yesterday. There's another aspect of the S-1 legislation that has hardly been mentioned by the media and not for its lack of importance. It would codify into law the Obama administration's $38 billion 10-year arms package to Israel, which had been blocked from being voted on during the last month of the last session by a hold placed by Senator Rand Paul, which was reported only in the Israeli and Jewish press and on this program. Such codification is deemed necessary by Israel and its supporters in Congress to ensure that the yearly gift of $3.8 billion minimally could not be tampered with by the whims of a U.S. president not so enchanted with pleasing Israel and its American donors as have been our current and previous three presidents. It may, I suspect, have something to do with shielding Israel from repercussions stemming from a questionable moves in the international arena that appear to be a direct challenge to U.S. policy. one which you probably haven't heard of or read about that qualifies as something more than questionable in U.S. eyes, is a 25-year deal that Israel has made with a Chinese company to expand and operate the port of Haifa beginning in 2021 that has disturbed Washington, as one might expect, and more immediately the U.S. Navy, which routinely uses Haifa as a friendly port. According to the Israeli press, the main stakeholder in the Chinese company, the Shanghai International Port Group, is the Chinese government. The Haifa port also sits close to Israel's Navy base that is home to the country's nuclear-armed submarine force. The Israeli government reportedly is working to defuse any problems that may arise from the Chinese takeover of the port, which has led the U.S. Navy to reconsider its future port calls and exercises in and with Israel. Israeli officials confirmed to the Jerusalem Post that the government was conducting an internal review to see how this arrangement occurred, as if it was a result of some accidental oversight, and reviewing how to ensure that, quote, the Chinese construction and the management of the port does not adversely impact ties with the U.S., end quote. Commander Kylie Rains from the U.S. 6th Fleet told the Post that there were currently no changes to operations in Israel, but he said, I can't speculate on what or might or might not occur in 2021. White House officials confirmed to the Jerusalem Post that John Bolton raised the Haifa port matter when he met Monday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, but apparently it was not considered an important enough story for our national media to mention. Regular listeners to Takes on the World are used to hearing many such stories that clearly Israel's domestic lobby prefers the American public not to know about. The background of John Bolton is another example. Never is it mentioned that Bolton, President Trump's national security advisor, appointed to the post at the urging of Republican mega-billionaire Sheldon Adelson, was hailed by Israel's ambassador to the UN as, quote, the sixth man in our office, end quote, when Bolton was ostensibly his American counterpart serving there. Only rarely are we reminded that Bolton was only in that position through a recess appointment by President George W. Bush when it was clear that he couldn't get approved for the job by a Republican-controlled U.S. Senate. Last November, also ignored by the mainstream media, was Bolton being honored with the, quote, Defender of Israel Award by the ultra-right-wing Zionist Organization of America, which not coincidentally had led the lobbying campaign to oust Bolton's predecessor, H.R. McMaster, as National Security Advisor. McMaster's support of the nuclear deal with Iran and his having referred to Israel once as a, quote, occupying power clearly overrode any other qualification he might have had for the job. It was therefore fitting that Bolton made his statement overruling Trump's promise to begin withdrawing troops from Syria while sitting with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu in Jerusalem on Sunday, since Netanyahu had expressed his opposition to the withdrawal and was, of course, the fiercest opponent of the nuclear agreement with Iran, even being allowed by the Republicans to speak against it to a joint session of Congress. Iran, of course, remains a primary target of Netanyahu, Bolton, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, not to mention the president. Pompeo surely earned the Chutzpah Award for January by saying that U.S. policy toward Iran, just the other day, speaking in Washington before embarking on an 8-day trip to the Middle East to reassure America's allies that the U.S. was not retreating from the region, and while not saying regime change is U.S. policy in Iran, he told Bloomberg News Eli Lake, quote, the charade of Iranian democracy is what we are hoping to fix. We want the Iranian people's voices to be heard. We want the government to be responsive to those voices, end quote. This August will mark the 65th anniversary of the overthrow of the democratically elected Prime Minister of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, by the CIA under Kermit Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's grandson, which ushered in 25 years of tyrannical rule by the Shah Reza Pahlavi, a crime far more devastating for the people of Iran and for the region at large than either the bombing of Pearl Harbor or 9/11 was for the people of the United States. No, not even close. And we are on the threshold of doing it again, leading with crippling economic sanctions, with no more consequences apparently than last time, and it being done out in the open. What was Mossadegh's crime back in 1954, you may wonder? It was nationalizing the country's oil industry and reserves, which were then being exploited by the Anglo-Iranian oil company, which BP. The same year would see the overthrow by Washington of another democratically elected president, Jacobo Arbenz, in Guatemala. He had the temerity to nationalize United Fruit and distribute land to the peasants, which President Eisenhower and the Dulles brothers, one the Secretary of State and the other the head of the CIA, saw as a threat to America's regional interest, which democracy in our hemisphere has always been. Finally, one of the unforeseen side effects of the shutdown of Washington is that U.S. aid to Palestinian Authority security forces is under threat of defunding. According to sources in Washington, the Palestinian Authority's forces, who collaborate closely with the Israeli security establishment in suppressing resistance to the occupation in the West Bank, may be forced to operate without U.S. assistance if the shutdown persists beyond the next 2 weeks. Additionally, the Anti-Terrorism Clarification Act, which you probably have never heard of, which became law in October, states that international entities that receive any form of foreign assistance from the U.S. will become vulnerable to lawsuits filed by U.S. citizens in American courts. The law seeks to allow American citizens who were victims of attacks by Palestinians to sue the Palestinian Authority for reparations. Previous attempts to file such lawsuits were blocked based on the argument that the U.S. judiciary doesn't have jurisdiction over the Palestinian Authority, but now we have learned, have we not, that the U.S. believes it and acts as if it has jurisdiction over the entire planet. The new legislation would seem to provide the Palestinian Authority with a clear incentive to stop receiving U.S. security assistance, as even accepting a single dollar from Washington would open it up to lawsuits. The Trump administration became aware of the problem only after it had been signed into law. It has since been trying to work with Congress to amend the legislation so that it won't prevent the Palestinian Authority from continuing its poisonous collaboration with Israel. In case you might be wondering, the bill passed the Senate by a voice vote in August and was approved by the House without a single objection in September before the president signed it into law in October. I could find no mention of it in the mainstream U.S. press. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. Well, the Israeli lobby is at it again with their under-the-radar shenanigans. When they cannot win legislative battles fighting out in the open, they resort to sneak attacks. Having failed to pass their unconstitutional anti-BDS legislation in the open, they are working to have it surreptitiously added to the Congressional Omnibus Spending Bill, where it will get no debate. I'm going to read from the ACLU publication outlining the issue. Quote, according to recent reports, congressional leaders from both sides of the aisle are planning to sneak a bill criminalizing politically motivated boycotts of Israel into the end-of-the-year omnibus spending bill. The bill's original sponsor, Senator Ben Cardin, is pushing Democratic leadership to include this bill, which has not moved forward thus far, primarily because it violates the First Amendment. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi are reportedly leaning towards slipping the text into the spending bill, which needs to pass for the government to stay open. The ACLU has long opposed the Israel Anti-Boycott Act through its multiple iterations because the bill would make it a crime to participate in political boycotts protected by the First Amendment. Now the bill's sponsors are attempting to avoid public scrutiny by including the bill's unconstitutional criminal penalties in must-pass legislation scheduled for a vote just days before Congress adjourns, likely because it will be harder to pass in the new Congress. Earlier versions of the Israeli Anti-Boycott Act would have made it a crime, possibly even subject to jail time, for American companies to participate in political boycotts aimed at Israel and its settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories when those boycotts were called for by international governmental organizations like the United Nations. The same went for boycotts targeting any country that is friendly to the United States, if the boycott was not sanctioned by the United States. The ACLU has seen an updated version being considered for inclusion in the spending bill. While Capitol Hill offices claim the First Amendment concerns have been resolved and potential jail time has indeed been eliminated as a possible punishment, the bill actually does nothing to cure its First Amendment problems. Furthermore, knowingly violating the bill could result in criminal financial penalties of up to $1 million. Were this legislation to pass, federal officials would have a new weapon at their disposal to chill and suppress speech that they find objectionable or politically unpopular. Consider, for example, if the United Nations advocated boycotting Saudi Arabia in response to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, a Washington Post journalist, or Russia in response to its alleged election interference around the world. That would mean American companies, small business owners, and even nonprofits, potentially some religious organizations, and people acting on their behalf in support of the boycott could be subject to criminal penalties. This is a full-scale attack on Americans' First Amendment freedoms. Political boycotts, including boycotts of foreign countries, have played a pivotal role in this nation's history, from the boycotts of British goods during the American Revolution, to the Montgomery bus boycott, to the campaign to divest from apartheid South Africa, and in NAACP versus Claiborne Hardware, the Supreme Court made clear that the First Amendment protects the right to participate in political boycotts. Although the bill states that nothing in the act shall be construed to diminish or infringe upon any other right protected under the Constitution of the United States, such hollow assurances do not undo its core purpose of penalizing First Amendment activities and silencing speech. Members of Congress who support this bill should take note of the fact that just this year, two federal courts blocked the state laws seeking to suppress boycotts of Israel. Those laws, like many copycats around the country, required state contractors to certify that they are not participating in boycotts of Israel as a condition of doing business with the state. The courts agreed with the ACLU that these anti-boycott laws violate Americans' First Amendment rights. The Israel Anti-Boycott Act is another page from the same unconstitutional playbook. It is clear why congressional leaders fear an open debate on this legislation. Restricting Americans' freedom of expression is rarely a popular policy. But that is no excuse for smuggling controversial new crimes into last-minute appropriations packages. If the First Amendment means anything, it's that the government cannot suppress political expression it does not like. Whatever their views on the Israel-Palestine conflict, members of Congress should oppose any effort to include this unconstitutional law within the omnibus spending bill. Americans' First Amendment rights are at stake. That was an analysis of the federal anti-boycott legislation published by the American Civil Liberties Union. However, Constitution be damned, the Israeli lobby will force the legislation under the radar come hell or high water. This needs to be stopped. Please call your congressional representatives and senators and urge them to defeat this sneak attack. And now on to our feature presentation, which this morning is two speeches delivered at the recent conference of the Jerusalem Fund at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. First, you will hear Josh Rubner, policy director at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, followed by Palestinian civil rights attorney practicing in New York, Lamis Deek. First, Josh Rubner.
I'd like to thank the Palestine Center for inviting me to speak here this morning. Palestinian Rights is a national coalition of more than 300 organizations across the country, including the Palestine Center as one of our longtime members and supporting organizations, so it's always good to be back here. Today we're convening this annual conference of the Palestine Center in the midst of what could be argued as an unprecedented crackdown and repression by the United States against the Palestinian people and against their legitimate rights. We see this take a myriad number of forms, from the cuts to UNRWA to the ending of bilateral quote-unquote humanitarian assistance from USAID, to the closure of the PLO office in Washington, D.C., to the transfer of the U.S. embassy to Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and to the dissolution of the U.S. consulate general in Jerusalem, which is actually, I believe, one of, if not the most significant, of these Trump administration efforts to repress the Palestinian people, even though in many respects has gotten the least attention of the Trump administration's many moves to repress the Palestinian people. And the reason why I believe that's the case is because it marks a very significant policy shift in the way that the United States thinks about its relationships with the Palestinian people. The U.S. Consul General actually predates the establishment of the State of Israel by some 80 years and actually predates the establishment of the modern Zionist movement by 20 years. And it's an institution which has always operated separately and independently from the U.S. Embassy to Tel Aviv to be the reporting channel to listen to the interests of the Palestinian people and report that directly back to Washington, D.C., without the interference of the embassy in Washington. And so for the Trump administration to subsume the consul general within this new U.S. embassy in Jerusalem and to create within the U.S. embassy to Israel an office for Palestinian affairs, despite Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announcing that this does not affect any so-called permanent status negotiations or positions of the United States, it actually does, because the United States is now articulating that it sees its relationship to the Palestinian people as officially a subset of its relation to Israel. So why is the Trump administration engaging in all of these steps to repress the Palestinian people? In my estimation, it's an attempt, a very heavy-handed attempt, to weaken and soften the Palestinian leadership in an attempt to get it to capitulate to what Trump has euphemistically referred to as the, quote, deal of the century, his plan to establish a permanent Israeli-Palestinian peace. Now, it should be noted, from the leaks and the bits of information about this so-called deal of the century, which have trickled out over the past year or so, that it does differ in some details from previous U.S. quote-unquote peace plans, but that it actually does not fundamentally differ in substance from previous offers made to the Palestinian people under the Clinton administration, under the George W. Bush administration, under the Barack Obama administration, which were, of course, all plans pre-coordinated and preconceived between Israel and the United States in an attempt to impose it on the Palestinian people. So under this plan, the quote-unquote state-minus aspects of the so-called Palestinian state that would arise are more explicit, more blatant than under previous plans. Israel might annex more of the West Bank under this plan than under previous plans, but in substance, it does not differ fundamentally from previous plans. The plan always was for a state minus. The plan always was for the Palestinian entity not to be a sovereign state, not to have an army, not to have an independent foreign policy, not to have any control over its borders, its airspace, its sea lanes. This was always the plan. The Trump administration has just made that plan much more explicit. And so, in addition to the repression that we're seeing the Trump administration engage in toward the Palestinian people in an attempt to get them to capitulate to U.S. and Israeli demands, we're also seeing intense repression facing people who advocate for Palestinian rights within the United States and indeed across the globe. We're seeing this through the Trump administration in the appointment of Kenneth Marcus to be the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights within the Department of Education. This is the job within the Department of Education that looks into allegations of discrimination and bigotry towards students on college campuses. And Ken Marcus comes to this position from a Zionist organization whose primary and sole mission was to file false allegations of anti-Semitism against student organizers for Palestinian rights on campus. In all five or six of the investigations that Kenneth Marcus either filed or conspired to help file, the Department of Education threw out these charges as being baseless and said that advocating for Palestinian rights constitutes legitimate political expression on campus, even if people are uncomfortable with it. What Kenneth Marcus has failed to do from the outside, he has been brought into the government by the Trump administration to now accomplish from within. And so already, he was just confirmed a few months ago, already he has reopened closed cases into alleged acts of anti-Semitism. And he has unilaterally decided that he is going to impose this redefinition of what constitutes anti-Semitism to include legitimate political criticisms of Israel within the orbit of that definition, so that the force of the federal government will now come down on student organizers for Palestinian rights who are advocating successfully on their campuses to pass boycott and divestment resolutions and to label them anti-Semitic for doing so. This attempt to repress coming from within the Trump administration is coupled with attempts coming from within Congress to repress on many different levels. And what I'd like to do is to point your attention to three pieces of outstanding legislation, which may or may not get debated and voted on in the three remaining weeks we have left in this congressional session. Number one is something called the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. This is a bill that would take what Kenneth Marcus is doing within the Department of Education and mandate that the Department of Education use this flawed definition of anti-Jewish bigotry as its standard for adjudicating whether there is bigotry on college campuses. Basically, it would be enshrining in law what Ken Marcus is already doing through the Department of Education. Number two, I'd like to draw your attention to something called the Combating BDS Act, which is being pushed by Senator Marco Rubio in the Senate. This is a bill that aims to encourage states and localities to pass the exact same types of laws which have been declared unconstitutional by two federal district judges that, in essence, punish people by refusing them contracts with the state for supporting boycotts for Palestinian rights. And the third and most draconian of the bills being debated in Congress relating to the repression of activism and advocacy for Palestinian rights is the Israel Anti-Boycott Act. This bill not only seeks to punish and harm people who advocate for Palestinian rights, but actually to throw them into jail for up to 20 years. This legislation states that if you provide information to, or if you advance an international organization's call to boycott Israel or even Israeli settlement products, if you do this, you are liable to criminal penalties of up to $1 million and 20 years in prison. With this amount of outright repression being openly and proudly debated by some in Congress, one might take it as a sign that Israel and its supporters are stronger than ever in this country. But I believe that the reverse is actually true, because all of this repression is not a sign of strength. You don't need to engage in repression if you think that you are winning. You engage in efforts to repress and to silence because you are on the losing side of history. And so I view this as an indication that we collectively are on the right track in advancing Palestinian rights in this country. Now, I would be a very bad organizer if I was all doom and gloom and did not leave you with at least a grain of hope. But I actually see much more than a grain of hope, not on the long-term horizon, but on the short-term horizon. And let me tell you why I think that the repression of the Trump administration, of Congress, of Israel is failing in three different reasons. Number one, this direct Trump administration effort to repress the Palestinian people in order to get them to try to capitulate to U.S.-Israeli demands has backfired. Even the compliance Palestinian Authority, which has been so quick to enter into and continue to perpetuate the charade of negotiations for 25 years. Even this attempt to crack down on the PA and to pressure it has backfired, with the positions taken by the Trump administration being so extreme that PA President Mahmoud Abbas has cut off all contact with the administration, and the feeling is mutual. No longer do we have a fig leaf of a dialogue. No longer do we have the fig leaf of Israelis and Palestinians sitting down together around the negotiating table. But we have a clear scenario in which it is the United States and Israel which is attempting to dominate and dictate a one-sided outcome, something which was already there, but it's just much more obvious now to everyone that this is the case. Number two, the attempts to repress people who are engaged in advocacy for Palestinian rights in the United States has also backfired tremendously. And even though you now have states, about 25 in number, which have passed laws to punish people who support boycotting for Palestinian rights, the negative ramifications and the pushback for engaging in this type of blatant behavior to silence our First Amendment right to engage in boycotts has been tremendous. So the fact that you have these laws introduced and passed at the state level and attempts to do so at the federal level has brought the American Civil Liberties Union onto our side, clearly defending our right to engage in this type of advocacy and these types of boycotts. And in fact, As I alluded to earlier, the ACLU, which is arguably one of the most influential civil society organizations in the entire country, has filed and successfully won 2 court cases challenging laws that have attempted to punish people who support boycotting for Palestinian rights. And in both cases, the federal district judges have, for the first time, set a precedent that, yes, indeed, we have a constitutional First Amendment protected right to engage in boycotts for Palestinian rights. And we also see that this repression at the congressional level has mobilized the ACLU to oppose all 3 bills, which I alluded to earlier, placing us and the ACLU in one corner and Israel and its supporters in the opposite side. And that's absolutely a fight that I want to have, and I think that we can win. Number 3, the identification of the Trump administration, not only with Israel, but with the extreme right annexationist apartheid impulses of the most right-wing government in the history of Israel, has not only enabled and continued a process of creating a partisan divide on this issue, but it has established a firm partisan divide. Republicans are now the party of Israel, and Democrats are the ones who are questioning that relationship and, in many cases, upending it. And so we heard a little bit about the results of the midterms, and we can look to innumerable public opinion polls to affirm this yawning chasm between the base of the Democratic Party and the base of the Republican Party. We see that there are now 31 Democratic members of Congress who are supporting, in this current congressional session, the first ever bill to advocate for Palestinian rights, unabashedly, without any mention of Israel's quote-unquote security, to say that abusing, interrogating, and in some cases torturing Palestinian children through Israel's military detention system is wrong, immoral, and no U.S. aid should be used for that purpose. We have a representative-elect, Rashida Tlaib, who not only supports a one-state resolution, but also supports sanctioning Israel until it ends its human rights abuses of the Palestinian people. And just the other day, we had another representative-elect, Ilhan Omar, from Minnesota, not only say that she supports our right to engage in boycott for Palestinian rights, but supports BDS. These type of developments were unimaginable in Congress even a year ago. And so I believe that if we work smart and if we work hard over the next 2 years and continue to seed this transformation that is beginning to manifest itself at the grassroots of the Democratic Party and now up to Congress, we will be in a position to create the fundamental transformation that we need to achieve Palestinian rights in 2020. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Josh. I believe we have Lamise on Skype. All right, that'll be our next speaker.
So thank you, Muhammad, and the Jerusalem Fund for accommodating the Skype intervention. I extend my apologies to everybody. I really wish I could be with you. And I want to give a special shout out to the woman I had hoped to see, Samira Saud. Thank you for all of your work and for this event, Suhair as well. It's good to see you. I could see you from here. I'd like to begin my portion by first and foremost, because I think it's always important for us to begin at the beginning, which is our people in Palestine and honoring our fallen heroes in Gaza, especially those who we lost over this weekend, and who in their sacrifice and in their act of what I think is the purest form of love, a not self-interested love, gave their lives to protect the 2 million people in Gaza who are imprisoned by Israel, and whom without the resistance are but 2 million hostages and walking targets of the Israeli colonizing project for ethnic cleansing, in particular the sacrifice of Sheikh Nur al-Din Baraki, Mustafa Ode, and Muhammad al-Tatari, which brought to Gaza and Palestine a tremendous victory by their discovery of an Israeli military cache inside of Gaza, which preempted a broader massacre, saved countless Palestinian lives, and materially protected the global struggle for peace, the global struggle for peace at which Palestine is most centrally situated and for which Palestine is best poised to push forward. BDS is our only form of indirect accountability, and the Palestinian resistance is the only form of direct accountability and preemption of Israeli violence that Palestinians have. And so it is my hope that we normalize and elevate the Palestinian resistance. Now, much like we saw stem from the attacks and violence and massacres in Gaza, especially the latest, what we see, as Josh touched upon, in the expanding circumference of Zionist and Israeli repression and violence, even in the U.S., is an exposure of Israeli weakness, an exposure of Israeli arrogance, in which is an opportunity, and of course, an exposure of their desperation. I'll address the dangerous repression that has plagued first and above all Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims in the United States, and which has had consequences far graver than what we see in the academy. Now, I personally join you as a member of an organization, perhaps one of the only organizations in the U.S. that has endured and fully and unequivocally defeated some of the most concentrated liquidation and counterintelligence efforts of Zionists and U.S. forces of repression. I myself was a primary target of this operation, which we deduced over a period of years, and which began on the same day that the Mavi Marmara was raided and continued until at least 2015. Palestinian repression of Palestinians in the U.S. did not begin after 9/11, but was a part of U.S. policy for decades. In fact, Nixon's Operation Boulder of the 70s and the Supreme Court's ruling related to this, that U.S. executive agencies are permitted to implement foreign policy by targeting dual nationals inside the borders of the United States is piece and parcel, and the original codification of the right to repress Palestinians and Palestinian speech. So what Josh was talking about is actually a reversal of the court's policy and pre-existing policies, and taken in context is actually a huge victory. Now, post 9/11, as many of you know, Palestinians, Palestinian organizations, Palestinian communities were the first and biggest target of the Patriot Act and its execution throughout the United States. I was practicing at the time, and I had already come to defending the Palestinian community even before I graduated law school. And so what we were watching were surreal, and I mean this with no exaggeration, surreal levels of very militant, made-for-TV type of surveillance. And case after case that appeared before the courts or in the news, framed as some big, terrorist plot, were manufactured cases that had been begun or were developed and prosecuted at the behest of and in coordination with Israeli and Zionist operatives and think tanks right there in D.C. And so it was in these cases that we first saw, right? We have to understand how this is all tied. And it was in these cases that we first saw the actual criminalization of speech on Palestine, even before it had reached the legislative effect. It was in the executive agencies, both state and federal, meant not just to chill speech on Palestine, but to terrorize and destroy entire communities in the U.S. and to break their relationship with international networks in support of Palestine. And it should have been, you know, it should have been scary at the time, but it got worse. Around the same time, the NYPD, in coordination with the CIA, which is not allowed to operate inside U.S. borders, though I've caught them doing that several times, in coordination with the CIA and in coordination with Israel, had set up a secret, illegal unit operating in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and likely elsewhere, that was modeled precisely on the Israeli network and surveillance and control practices and policies used in the West Bank. So we had inside the United States a mechanism modeled and coordinated with the Zionist entities, practices and policies of controlling, killing, and colonizing people. And this was implemented in the United States. Now, their tactics were so thuggish and so brazen and so arrogant that it was because of their infiltration of our organization with the exposure and our ability to decode what they were really doing that not only led to the dismantlement for the most part of this unit, but even caused and birthed and really succeeded in removing, you know, the sacred at that time police commissioner Ray Kelly from his post. And so our, you know, ragtag operation, which had a budget of anywhere between $1,000 and $3,000 each year, defeated a multi-million dollar NYPD project with the might of Israel behind it. And that is a tremendous, tremendous victory. Now, our organization was, let me start by saying this. I use this as an example, and I've got countless more perhaps that are better, but I'm here and I'm trying to keep it short. What I want us to take away from what Josh said and what I'm trying to convey to you are a few points. Number one, we cannot and we must make sure that we study and understand the detailed minutiae of coordination between Israel, the United States, and international forces of repression. An example. At the same moment that the Mavi Marmara was being raided, if everybody is familiar with the Mavi Marmara, May 2010, yes, I see heads shaking. At the same time that the Mavi Marmara was raided, Obama dispatched a team of lawyers and strategists from the United States to Israel to help save Israel from its legal and PR nightmare. On that very same day is when the NYPD sent two undercover agents to infiltrate our organization, which would, you know, really deplete our resources, though we defeated them, deplete our resources for approximately 5 years. On the anniversary of Nakba, almost every year for a number of years, various agencies, federal and state, would parade around a case that involved Palestinians. Even when it was a blatant lie, and it often was a blatant lie, to the point that judges would tell the prosecutors, what does this have to do with terrorism? This is a regulatory case. This is a criminal case. But they would parade around so as to criminalize and deplete any resource they could for the commemoration of a Nakba. This is how detailed the coordination is between U.S., New York, state, federal agencies and Israel. And it's important that we understand that there are no coincidences and that we prepare for this. Number two, we should know and always keep in mind whenever we're dealing with any case that no case that we're addressing, whether it's the legislation, the campus cases, the actual criminal prosecutions, nothing is isolated. This is internationally coordinated on every level. And so our approach to this must also be multi-layered and cross-continental. We saw that in the adoption of the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism in the UK. Not 2 weeks later, it's being used by the Department of Education here. And lastly, in all of this, even in the legislation, the infiltration that we endured, it's important that we are very attentive to what's happening, and know that if we employ just a modicum of creativity and courage, we have many gains to be made. I'm going to use myself as an example. There is nothing particular about me other than I work hard and I hope, inshallah, that I'm very committed to my people here and in Palestine. And in my practice, I've lost very few cases, alhamdulillah, but I take no credit for this, right? One case I lost and it was reversed on appeal, a political case. Another, we had to take the offer because it was too good to pass up. And the third was an issue of proportionality. But all of the cases that I've won in my practice, domestic or international strategizing, were always a result of mistakes made specifically because of government arrogance and their kind of getting high on their own power. And like Josh said, in this arrogance are critical opportunities for us to seize. Like I said, our organization, $3,000 at best, our annual budget, were able to take down and render useless a multi-million dollar project, right? And second, the wholesale unmasking, you know, of even the facade of diplomacy and the exposure of Israeli desperation, brute violence, brute repression, reveals a deep fear, which is, you know, and exposes them. And that's a lot easier to address and push back against than what we saw under the Obama administration, which is this invisible, omnipresent, you know, kind of unable, you can't convince people it's happening. And so for years, we were forced to work alone. And so it's an opportunity. And I bring that, you know, and I say this to Riyad Mansour's point as well. Yes, the nation state law is horrible. But in this is the only time that we are seeing the UN trying to hold Israel accountable for its finally honest admission that it is, in fact, an apartheid state. Some might think that the closure of the PLO mission is a problem. Maybe, maybe not. That's not my perspective, quite frankly, because what I see happening, and if you know the conditions of having the PLO mission in DC, I mean, they were so horrible that the PLO mission was effectively made hostage, right? It was controlled by these awful conditions, which prevented the PLO mission and thereby the Palestinian Authority from protecting and acting in the interests not just of Palestinians in Palestine, but of Palestinians in the U.S. So what does this mean for us? This means for us the peeling of the facade of an administrative layer that serves our interests opens the door for us to become creative and to take up those spaces and to undo the failures of those conditions of having that mission here based in DC. So this is a tremendous opportunity. I do not see this as a defeat. And lastly, for some perspective again, and to bring it back to Palestine, in 2014, the entire Palestinian gross domestic product, the entire Palestinian GDP was $7.5 billion. In that same year, the Israeli military budget alone was $23.5 billion, excluding another $3.5 billion in direct military aid from the U.S. So $7.5 billion Palestinian GDP to $26-27 billion just on military, spent on a starved, besieged, Bantustanized, if that's a word, occupation, and still the resistance in Palestine, the resistance in Gaza, not only defeated them strategically and militarily, but politically and psychologically won hearts of the masses across the world. And if they are able to do this, we are capable of so much more. All we need is some courage, some commitment, and some elbow grease, right? No cause and no case has ever been won by the timid. And in closing, to bring it back to the Great Return March, you know, it is unfortunately a failure of our negotiators that for 70 years we have left the Palestinian right to return as a footnote. Right. And in post-Oslo, having it as that footnote is what has really defeated, strategic gains for Palestinian return and liberation. What we saw the Great Return March do just in the past 5 months was more productive and more materially beneficial to Palestinian return. And again, I say in real, direct, material ways, therefore, more beneficial to the struggle for global and regional peace and stability than people in D.C. and London and Ramallah have been able to do for 50 years.
You have been listening to Josh Rubner and Lamas Deek speaking together on a forum at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
American 11, are you trying to call?
Nobody moves. Everything will be okay. If you try to make any move, you'll danger yourself and the airplane. Let's stay quiet.
Roger's weapon, Sergeant Powell.
Hi, Boston Center, TMU. We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York, and we need you guys to, we need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there to help us out.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise, not a test.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Canadian professor and author of, they may say, wonderful book about the exploitation and genocide in North America by John Cabot's successors and the Merchant Venturers. The book is Earth into Property, Colonization, Decolonization and Capitalism. It's Anthony Hall. With me, Tony Gosling. Distraction politics, the trumped-up wall. Although the evidence is it will make little difference, it's become Trump's touchstone policy. He was elected to build it, but aren't the Republicans all for minimal government? A shutdown suits them nicely. Is the shutdown just a sneaky way to bring in Republican policies that would otherwise be impossible to get away with? Part of a wider agenda, maybe, both sides of the Atlantic and beyond, to shut down and bankrupt democratic governments and hand us over to the oligarchy, ruled by banksters and big business. And whatever happened to the Minsk Agreement? Fake news on the BBC World Service. Their reporter Jonah Fisher says that Russia and Ukraine are at war. Could you believe that? What does he base this on? And what happens when he's questioned about his claim? And the Israel lobby. Former New Yorker, international relations academic Ron Mendel is a new arrival here in Bristol. We talked to him about the hidden Israeli influence on media and politics, both sides of the Atlantic. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM on Tuesday at noon. This week, it's Stonehenge, Glastonbury, and even Ingleston Common in Yate. How are they all connected? Well, we speak to Brig Ubridge, who was on the Peace Convoy for many years, and then he ended up starting something called the Big Green Gathering. He takes us through that history of travellers from the 1960s, 70s and 80s. So I'm joined on the line from Lethbridge, Alberta, I believe, by Anthony Hall. Hi, Anthony. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Great to be here, Tony. Thanks for inviting me.
Can you just give us, first of all, a little bit of introduction to yourself? What got you interested in history, particularly colonialism, and ending up writing this book about colonization, decolonization, and capitalism?
Well, I became very fascinated with Indian country, the reality that First Nations who dominated the Western Hemisphere in 1492, you know, have been pushed to the margins and yet still are here. The languages still can be spoken. And so I started to look into that history. And of course, in order to look into that history, you have to look into, say, church archives, records, military records. You have to learn a lot of history to understand how this relations with First Nations developed. Increasingly, I saw this as part of a global story. I started looking at very particular situations in Canada, then thought I have to broaden it out to North America. And after all, many of the peoples in the world could be considered indigenous peoples, and most of the world has been colonized by, for instance, the British Empire and ships going out of Bristol. Anyway, there is a large pattern there. And the global war on terror is sort of the latest initiative of this imperial trajectory. And I've tried to put it all together in a big kind of global picture: earth into property, colonization, decolonization, and capitalism.
Now, why do you use this expression earth into property? What does that mean?
Well, I think it's quite evocative. When you think of the Western Hemisphere in 1492, it wasn't considered property. There was no system to evaluate it and mortgage it and sell it. So how we have transformed our earth into morsels, into fragments, into pieces of private property, we can think about, you know, the earth itself and real estate. We can think about mortgages. We can think about insurance. We can think about futures. We can think about the stock market. It's really amazing how innovative we have been as humanity, especially the trajectory of capitalist humanity, in dividing up the world into pieces of property that can be owned and bought and valuated, put on the marketplace. And of course, the relationship with indigenous peoples, this has a lot to do with that relationship. And that's my big theme. Of course, it's a big part of the history of capitalism. Karl Marx was quite interested in the history of capitalism. The history of capitalism is a big subject for historians, and I've tried to contribute to it.
What sort of role, how big a role do you think John Cabot and his trip from Bristol to Newfoundland, it was only just a beginning? What sort of happened, I suppose, in the immediate years after that? Because I think initially, when ships arrived, they tried to make good relations, friendly relations with the Native Americans. It quite quickly turned sour, though.
Well, the French Empire based its imperial aspirations in the northern part of the continent on the fur trade. So they had to make friends with Indian people. A lot of the British colonization was agriculture-based, and it was antagonistic to indigenous peoples. Of course, you know, John Cabot, Christopher Columbus, this early wave of conquistadors, explorers, tried to understand where they were. They were mostly looking for a route to China. I'm quite interested in taking the history a little further. You talked to me about Edward Colston, and his important role in the history of your community as a sort of philanthropist who made a lot of money in the slave trade. And I found this drew me into particularly a focus on the restoration, the fact that after 1660, the period when Colston was emerging as a major figure, the British monarchy was reinstated after Cromwell and the Civil War and such. And there was an incredible era of creation of corporations using the power of the crown to create new corporations, like the Corporation of the Carolinas, like the corporation that was handed over to William Penn, and he became the founder of Pennsylvania, the one closest to us here in Canada, the creation of the corporation. And this is all by, you know, Charles the First's son, Charles the First, who had his head cut off, Charles the Second. He sort of seizes upon this power of creating corporations. And so the Hudson's Bay Company sort of steps in where the French have been, and this idea of a fur trade with the Indians. Of course, in order to do that, you have to have fairly friendly relations with the Indian people. Nevertheless, how is it that Charles II simply hands over a great chunk of the world to his cousin Rupert, Rupert's land, all the land drained by waters flowing into Hudson's Bay, which is a huge part, say two-thirds of what exists in Canada now, of the territorial base of Canada. You know, this is an interesting question.
I'd like to just throw in something there. I'd like to just throw something in there because, of course, Prince Rupert in the Civil War in the 1640s had been a major royalist commander right through the Civil War. So it may have been simply, you know, here's his reward.
Yeah, that's what it is. Obviously, the crown found a source of patronage. You know, already the East India Company had shown the riches available for that kind of enterprise. And actually, Charles II, he seizes on the idea of Greenwich, and says, well, let's make that the basis of longitude. And, you know, eventually that decision reflects and is projected into, you know, how time is calculated and where you start the clock and in the different time zones as you create time zones. I mean, there was a lot of creativity coming from the monarchy in that period. Pennsylvania, which is a creation of Charles II, I mean, William Penn was a Quaker. Society of Friends, he actually said, well, it's not good enough to just get a grant from the English king to create this colony. I have to go to the Indian nations, much like Roger Williams, who founded Rhode Island. He went to the Indian nations and said, give me some kind of charter, give me some kind of permission to create this colony. And this was the basis of Indian treaties, you know, and Indian treaties are still being negotiated in Canada, in, for instance, British Columbia. So in looking into Edward Colston and this period of the restoration of the monarchy, one of the first things that the new Charles II does, he sends his brother to take over New Netherlands and create it as New York, to take over the Dutch colony, the Netherlands, New Netherlands, New Amsterdam, New York, and he, in the process, they kind of take over the relations with the Haudenosaunee, the League of the Iroquois, the kind of protocol of relations. And there's a very interesting saga of sort of creative diplomacy of the British Empire with that particular group of Iroquoian people, but especially the Mohawks. And it turns out that, you know, they become very close to the crown and fight on the British side in the era of the American Revolution. Well, what is this American Revolution? Where does that come from? This becomes a big subject for me in my research.
What about today, though, the Native Americans? I mean, maybe you can give us your rough estimate of the genocide, the number of Native Americans that were killed, and what's the situation for them in the U.S. and Canada today?
Yes, well, if we want to talk about the genocide, I would say, well, let's put the beginning of this genocidal process in 1492. Of course, the Spanish Empire, shortly after that, the Portuguese Empire, which is the basis of today's Brazil. I mean, they are notorious for their conquistadors for pillaging and raping and seizing gold and enslaving Indian people.
But hang on, Anthony. When you're talking about the conquistadors, there seems to be some pretty strong evidence that the rule in South America, some of the empires that were there were extremely unpopular amongst the people that lived there, and that when the conquistadors arrived, that they were actually welcomed by some people and given all the information they needed to overthrow those empires.
Well, of course, this is the basis of imperialism. This is the basis of empire building, divide and conquer. And there was a plenty of opportunity for that. Cortez, his mistress, Malinche, gave him a lot of very important information about this group disliking that group. And you could play on this. I mean, think of the era where the U.S. Army is trying to track down Geronimo, you know, the famous Apache resistance fighter, and they work with Apache scouts. They hire Apaches to help with tracking down another Apache. This divide and conquer, you know, is a basic tactic of imperialism, and it was basic to the European colonization of the Americas. The Aztec were, you know, in a very kind of fragile position at the pinnacle of a complex power network, and the Spanish effectively exploited that. But in so doing and overturning, you know, very major civilizations with a lot of scientific knowledge and a lot of their own insights into agriculture, into, you know, irrigation, into all kinds of subjects, you know, we would be stronger as humanity if, rather than pillaging those societies, we had looked at them in more egalitarian terms and tried to understand one another and study one another rather than, you know, convert, you know, simply say, well, you're all wrong, your religion is all wrong, you must take our religion. I mean, it's established patterns which continue today. So when we talk about genocide, the genocide that took place in the Western Hemisphere is kind of unparalleled. Some estimate that maybe 100 million Native people met their deaths prematurely, you know, in the opening phases of this, and it never really ended. I mean, Ojibwe language, Native languages in Canada, they have no real official status. The official languages are English and French. The marginalization of Indigenous peoples in the Americas has been, you know, very extreme, less so in Central and South America, where, you know, a vast majority of the population are actually mestizo and have Indian ancestors and identified to some extent as Indigenous peoples. But in North America, you have a very sort of concentrated, dramatic episode of sort of settler colonization. And when the United States was created, you know, the Declaration of Independence, in pointing out the alleged crimes of King George, the author of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, he specified that one of the key crimes of King George was to bring on the merciless Indian savages, whose known means of warfare is undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. I mean, this could be interpreted as the creation of the global war on terror, the sort of roots of the global war on terror. There are merciless Indian savages. Their known means of warfare is undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. In other words, they do indiscriminate violence against men, women, children. They are not to be included in the concept of, you know, the equality of humanity, the idea that there is a universal system of human rights, which sort of is the reputation that the American Declaration of Independence
You've pointed out that there are some similarities between Geronimo and Osama bin Laden. I'd be interested if you could just clarify that.
Well, when Osama bin Laden was supposedly hunted down by Navy SEALs in 2011, his code name in the military establishment was Geronimo. And so that was how he was spoken about sort of in professional circles. And so these two personalities are sort of merged. And, of course, I think it's kind of a tall tale that the real Osama bin Laden was hunted down sort of Wild West style, dead or alive. I mean, if you're going to apprehend the person who you say is the most integral, you know, knowledgeable terrorist in history, in the whole system, you might want to take some care to apprehend him in a way that you could ask him some questions and pick his mind about what he knew. But no, the story was 2011, they're going to hunt down bin Laden and they end up burying him at sea. That's the story. Well, as I see it, what this really was all about was, you know, the 10th anniversary of 9/11. There was going to be a trial in New York of Khaled Sheikh Mohammed, the supposed mastermind of 9/11. That sort of broke down. We don't really have trials concerning what really happened on 9/11. So this hunt down of bin Laden, who is codenamed Geronimo, this becomes a kind of opportunity for Obama's administration, you know, new to the White House, to kind of turn the page and invent its own version of the global war on terror and continue the narrative, but it's with its own sort of democratic twist.
One of the things I found so shocking, really, about the killing of bin Laden by SEAL Team 6, if I can say it, was that the many of those soldiers subsequently died in all sorts of strange... Well, I think there was one main circumstance where a helicopter crashed or something, and many of them never lived to tell anyone about it. Also, we had the dumping of bin Laden's body at sea. Many people have suggested that actually bin Laden died back in 2001, potentially, out of kidney disease. So the whole thing could be a complete fantasy set up and just injected fake news, basically, for the public. We saw, famously, a picture of the cabinet, the US cabinet, looking around under, I think it was under Obama, watching this happen, and everyone is supposedly watching as it's happening, but we're never allowed to see the screen. So this photo itself could just be a psyop. I mean, what do you make of that whole incident?
Well, the idea of burying bin Laden at sea, in other words, he's gone, he's whisked out of, you know, any material existence, there's no credible evidence that it was actually him, and this deception, and of course the deception around bin Laden and Al-Qaeda as the culprits of 9/11, this is part of a, you know, huge deception. It's so, you know, monumental in scale to deal with 9/11, this early story that we were told basically within hours that it somehow bin Laden was responsible. Then within a couple of days, it's 19 people with box cutters. Very soon, even the BBC goes out and finds that many of these people that supposedly hijacked and crashed these planes were found to be living and whatnot. So the whole myth of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, I mean, this goes back to Afghanistan. This goes back to the effort to overthrow the Soviet-backed regime in Afghanistan and creating Al-Qaeda and a kind of foreign legion, a sort of Islamic foreign legion, and funding this creation and funneling money through ISI in Pakistan, you know, the CIA working closely with ISI in Pakistan. And then, of course, after 9/11, Al-Qaeda becomes, you know, very important in U.S. operations in Bosnia, in the Balkans, and even Al Qaeda even shows up in Syria, and it's sort of under a new name. So there is the U.S. government and other governments helping Al Qaeda supposedly to overthrow the Assad regime in Syria. But wait a minute now. Weren't we told that Al-Qaeda did 9/11? Well, we know the government helped Al-Qaeda, in fact, kind of created Al-Qaeda with recruiting, with funding, before 9/11 in the Afghanistan situation. And so this creation of the imagery of bin Laden as sort of chief terrorist number one, a CIA agent who was, in dialysis in July in, was it Dubai, just a couple of months before 9/11, visiting with the CIA because he had urinary problems. Yes, I think it's, most credible that bin Laden didn't live too long after 9/11.
Now, and, just a minute, one other aspect of bin Laden is that the SEAL Team 6 crash. Some of the families say, and this is a report in the Washington Times, families suspect Team Teal 6 crash was an inside job on the worst day in Afghanistan. I'll put a link up to that on our show page. That's on October the 20th, yeah. 2013. So they feel apparently that someone was involved in that. This was some sort of attack on a Chinook helicopter by someone within the American Security Service themselves. But let's not dwell too much on bin Laden. I think it's great, fascinating that, to see the parallels between Geronimo then and now. Well, I mean, what does what happened in the colonization of America tell us? What you've learnt about the military-industrial complex today, about where this war on terror is heading, because it does seem to have hit a bit of a brick wall in Syria. We're just hearing literally this week about US troops being pulled out of Syria. This was on Wesley Clark list of countries that they wanted to take over, 7 countries in 5 years. Now I'm afraid the Russian Federation are very firmly ensconced, being invited in by Assad of Syria. Those Russian bases at Tarsus, etc., it looks like they're staying. So what do you think of the apparent brick wall that this war on terror has now hit 18 years after, or 17 years after it started with those 9/11 attacks, attempting really to set the scene for the whole of the 21st century, this war on terror now grinding to a halt, Anthony?
Well, whether it's grinding to a halt, I think that would be premature to say that. We've got so many balls up in the air. Let me try to make sense of this. When you talk about the convenient disappearance of the Navy SEAL team that supposedly took out bin Laden. I mean, we see a lot of this in false flag terrorism. Just recently in Strasbourg, there are the yellow vests, building up their credibility, building up their momentum, and suddenly there's a terrorist event, an Islamic terrorist goes haywire in Strasbourg and sort of takes the wind out of the sails of this movement. I mean, how many of these episodes do the people who could give evidence end up dead? There's nobody to give testimony. There's no basis for future trials. The disappearance of people is incredible. I mean, I don't think it's an overstatement to say that on 9/11 we began to be immersed into a kind of dark ages. And one of the early things that happened was to rev up the torture chambers. And, they didn't actually chase down Al-Qaeda. They rounded up a lot of Muslim people and Arab people who didn't have their passports in order. So they were able to fill jails with, brown-skinned people who were Muslim, but they didn't deal with, for instance, the urban moving system of Israelis, two of which were said to be Mossad, who, were filming the event on the morning of 9/11. The spies, the dozens of spies that were picked up, Israeli spies, they were all sent home to Israel. Al-Qaeda wasn't really tracked down, but you had a sort of random collection of Islamic and Arab people. So this 9/11 episode, look at you know, the way the internet is going, look at the way we're being censored, look at the surveillance state. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that we were plunged into a kind of dark age. I mean, what I went through here in University of Lethbridge in Alberta, you know, where I'm talking as I talk, and suddenly I've got the Israel lobby on my case, you know, writing stories about me that somehow it's hateful to, you know, try to keep a critical perspective on what's really going on and to speak to some of the biggest, hardest issues of war and peace, life and death in our time. You know, how many millions of people killed in Iraq, you know, the crimes against humanity, the lack of accountability, the fact that we don't get investigations into anything. I remember the time of Watergate, Iran-Contra, the Church Commission. I mean, we have investigations that sort of go up into the late 1980s. But after 9/11, everything is just under a veil. And those who talk about these things, it is dangerous to do so. I'm 67 years old. I'm recently retired, but I went through an episode here. We've talked about it. You know, you look at Vanderpeel, you know, he makes a little tweet, and suddenly.
Hey, this is, you're talking about the international relations professor Kees van der Peel at Sussex University, the Dutch guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you look at the experience of Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, it's just not seemed to be acceptable in very, you know, in certain circles of power and influence that you say anything critical about Israel and treatment of Palestinians. Now, very early on, Netanyahu was saying 9/11 was good for Israel because people will empathize with us. And now it's very common for the Israeli government to speak about Palestinians basically as terrorists. And this word terrorism is so, you know, used so flippantly to discredit people. Corrupt regimes in power everywhere, they regularly refer to their opponents as terrorists. You know, we just can't get the context anymore for rational discussions based on evidence. And, you know, so this is why I say that we're in, you know, a dark age, and we can talk about the kind of ridiculous scenario presented to us that the Navy SEALs hunt down Bin Laden, Geronimo, as if he's some kind of desperado in the Wild West. Only it's Abbott's, you know, only it's in Pakistan. And you know, the idea of burying the guy at, you know, in the ocean, as if this is somehow reflective of Muslim heritage and religion. I mean, it's one absurd story after the next.
Anyway, look, you just brought up the Israel lobby there, and it just so happens that I met up with a guy from New York originally. He's now settled in the UK with his wife, and he's moved to Bristol recently. His name is Rob Mendel, and here he is talking to me early this week about that transatlantic Israel lobby.
It operates not only officially in terms of, you know, groups that are recognized as lobbyists, but it's the lobby basically has support among informally among Jewish groups. For example, I'll just give you another example. In California, Angela Davis was supposed to be awarded some something in recognition by the Civil Rights Institute in California.
So who is she?
Angela Davis was an African-American leader in the late 1960s and 70s, and has written on black feminism, and she was a member of the Communist Party at one stage, and then left after the Communist Party basically fell apart, after the Soviet Union collapsed. And Jewish groups in California put pressure on the Institute to withdraw the invitation. So she's now been denied being recognized as being an advocate of civil rights. And her statement was very interesting. She said, I don't take this personally. I don't think it's undermining me, but it's basically undermining all those who are fighting for social justice. So you have in universities attempts basically to silence anyone who criticizes Israel. There are 26 states in the United States which have passed or are considering passing laws to prohibit the advocacy of boycott, disinvestment, and sanctions. 26 states. Amazing. And even in Congress right now, there is some discussion of passing a law to criminalize BDS.
Well, that's the precise campaign which was so successful in South Africa.
That's exactly right. So that's how the lobby works. The lobby works. The lobby, in some sense, is not it's not a conspiracy. It's basically it's getting the word out that certain things are off limits. Certain things are illegitimate, and you have a consensus, unfortunately, within the both parties, Democrats and Republicans, maybe with a few exceptions of Democrats, who see Israel basically as being a beacon of democracy, but the outpost of civilization in the Middle East, and will never question Israel.
Now, I've read a few articles the last couple of months, a couple comparing the whole 1950s McCarthyism. Are you a communist? Have you ever been a member of a communist party? To the way that anti-Semitism is being treated nowadays. Is that something that you think that's a bit of a comparison too far? Or is that
No. I think that's an apt analogy. I think that's very insightful, actually. And it's a way of silencing people. People who put their heads above the parapet and just, questioning the practices of a state and holding them accountable to international conventions and international law, and basically trying to cow them. And anyone who basically advocates BDS is seen to be anti-Semitic. And I don't see that as, I think you could be – there's a very strong Jewish tradition. I remember going to Hebrew school. I went to Hebrew school for 3 years in the United States. And we were always told that we had a moral duty to speak out against social injustice, no matter where we saw it and no matter who was perpetuating it. So it's a very strong ethical and moral tradition within Judaism, which I hold dear. So I don't see there's any contradiction in being a Jew and being critical of Israel. And as a Jew, I could say that. And I could say there are Christians, likewise, the Judeo-Christian tradition, who likewise basically be compelled to speak out against injustice. And I don't see that as being anti-Semitic.
What about the confusion, you might call it, between the Jewish identity as a racial thing and as a religion? Because I think for some people that is difficult to untangle. The two seem to have been mixed together somehow.
That's exactly right. I think the turning point, because if you look at the history or the evolution of Zionism, Zionism was a minor undercurrent within the Jewish communities, both in this country and the United States, after the Holocaust. The Holocaust basically was the turning point. Until the Holocaust, most Jews were assimilating or acculturating in the societies they lived in. The immigrants who came from Russia and Eastern Europe to this country, the United States, they adopted new homelands, whether it be Britain or the United States, and they settled. And they thought themselves as being British or American. The Holocaust was the turning point, because then Zionism attains kind of the higher terrain, basically, and gains legitimacy.
At the same time, it got land, too.
That's exactly right. Exactly. So now, I think you're quite right. Most Jews will identify with the State of Israel. So it's very tricky, and this is really difficult, to separate out the Jewish identity from the State of Israel, because for many Jews who are secular, they're not religious, right? They strongly identify with Israel because they see that as basically a source of pride, a source of empowerment, a source of security and so forth. So it's very difficult to kind of separate those things out. I don't see being a Jew a nationality. Judaism is a religion, So I don't see...
But you talk about yourself as Jewish.
Yes.
Are you religious? You go to synagogue every Saturday?
No. I followed Ernest Hemingway's, adage, when he was a devout Catholic. And he said, if you're a Catholic, either you practice Catholicism or you break altogether. And it's the same thing as a Jew. I went to synagogue for 3 years. You know, my mother kept a kosher home, but I broke from it, you know. But again, it's still part of my cultural, you know, DNA. You know, you can't simply just disavow everything that you were, you know.
No, and you wouldn't necessarily want to. There are certain parts of it you want to hang on to.
Exactly, exactly.
So that was that. I was just speaking there with Ron Mendel, who's just arrived here in Bristol from Northampton and originally from New York. I mean, what do you make of what he was saying there about the Israel lobby, Tony?
Well, there's been some big revelations about the Israel lobby in action. For instance, the Al Jazeera documentaries. There's one on UK, four-part series, and there's a four-part series on the lobby, the Israel lobby, USA. And it was kept from the airwaves of Al Jazeera. The government of Qatar was subject to Zionist pressure, and it didn't get broadcast there. But it did get posted on Electronic Intifada, and it's available on Electronic Intifada. And it focuses a lot on the treatment of BDS and how afraid people are in Israel that the younger generation is turning against, not necessarily turning against Israel, but not as loyal as they might have been in the past. And so the idea of taking action on campus to prevent this trend, and that focus of campus activity is boycott, divestments, and sanctions, BDS campaign. And this becomes the target of a lot of pressure. And this pressure comes directly from the Israeli government. And that's one of the revelations of this documentary, who work with these organizations on the various campuses, the Zionist organizations on the various campuses. And the Israeli government makes available, you know, software, spyware. They develop files on people and are able to blackmail people, intimidate people, use information garnered on the internet in various ways. It's a very important documentary and is available at Electronic Intifada. The guest you had on is speaking of, you know, injustice. When you see injustice, well, to me, the great injustice of the lies and crimes of 9/11, it's this smearing, it's this blackening the name and the image and the reputation of all Islamic people on earth, the Ummah. And you come up again and again in face with this term Islamophobia, you know, fear of Muslims. And so that was definitely how 9/11 was presented to us. This was a crime of Muslim extremists, with Osama bin Laden as a, you know, major personification of extremists who hate our freedoms, who have a kind of irrational hatred of the West.
Well, this is really propaganda, actually, I'd argue, Anthony. This is propaganda. We've seen something quite recently. Just before Christmas, it was allowed. It was printed in the British papers. There's something called the Integrity Initiative here in the UK. It was a little office based in an old derelict mill in Scotland, which had got something like £2 million worth of money from the Foreign Office, and they had they were publishing a guide to countering Russian disinformation. That was what they were supposed to be doing. Really, of course, it's a propaganda outfit, but they were also smearing Jeremy Corbyn in their tweets as well. So what they've done is they've tried to shut down their Twitter account by protecting it. In other words, making so that only the people they want to see their tweets can see them. But I've been sent an extract from their report, a guide to countering Russian disinformation. A whole load of information about myself. It says, a British so-called expert, in inverted commas, who frequently appears on Russia Today, although I haven't for over 3 years now, is Tony Gosling. Even though he's described as a historian, he has never taught history nor written any books about it. In fact, his views on history are driven by a conspiracy theory which holds a secret society within the Freemasons called the Illuminati, which briefly existed in Bavaria in the late 18th century, close brackets, controls most world events today. His views were exposed in 2015 in an article by Adam Holland on the Daily Beast website. Russia Today has an Illuminati correspondent, really? Well, this is a complete and utter misrepresentation of my views. I have a part history degree. I've written many articles on history. I've looked very deeply into the English Civil War, into the Second World War and elsewhere. So this is really just total disinformation and lies being paid for with public money. I find it pretty shocking. But look, before we look at the go into some of the more the up-to-date things with Trump on the wall, Anthony, with you, I'd like you to give us your takes, particularly since you're from Canada, on this incredible arrest of Meng Wanzhou from the Huawei, because this is an enormous provocation against the Chinese. The idea that if someone from China trades with Iran, that then it's okay for one of the United States' proxies up in Canada to arrest them. It's pretty incredible, and it's been an enormous spin-off with scores of people being arrested by the Chinese, and we hear this week someone in Poland being arrested from Huawei too.
Yes, this is a major story. I think it's not an overstatement to say that Meng Wanzhou, the arrest of Meng Wanzhou in Vancouver by the Canadian government, amounts to a kind of act of war. This woman is the daughter of the equivalent of Steve Jobs in China, you know, a very celebrated family. When do we see top executives in major corporations getting, you know, publicly arrested on airplanes and such? I mean, we went through the whole financial debacle of 2008 and all the criminality at the high levels of the banking regime and all the payouts and bailouts and quantitative easing, the handing over of trillions of dollars, in scam after scam after scam in the era of financial deregulation. And then along comes this arrest, this high-profile arrest by Canada. And, you know, many people in Canada are saying Justin Trudeau is in over his head. He doesn't, you know, he's not like his father. He's not a well-educated person. This was a bad move on his part. And now Canadians are being arrested in China and held in custody. And obviously it's a bit of a response. If you're going to do this to our people in China, this is going to be the response. I mean, let's consider the strategic importance of what company emerges at the peak of the sort of cell phone digital device chain of command, feeding order. I mean, it's of enormous significance. Much of the spying takes place on these devices, the surveillance, and the idea that she was arrested because a company, not the big company, but a smaller company in Hong Kong doing business with, what is it, Hongwei, the big cell phone company, a company connected to that company did business with Iran. And, you know, how is it in the interests of Canada or the United States or Britain to demonize Iran? And how, you know, where do these sanctions come from? John Bolton seemed to be the operative in the U.S. government putting pressure on the Canadian government. John Bolton is generally seen as a kind of an extension of Sheldon Adelson, who has a great deal of power in the Republican Party, including over the president, you know, through the vast financial contributions he makes. And we're in an era of Citizens United where money, the power of money, is sort of completely unrestrained in the U.S. Political system. So this can be conceived as an act of war taken, and it's being taken very, very seriously in China. And of course, part of the sort of mismanagement of our governments in this sort of dark era of the global war on terror is that, you know, how are we going to align internationally the global superpowers? And, you know, if Russia and China are pulled together, that's not good for the United States. Where does the European Union fit in all of this? Is it an adjunct of U.S. power?
Perfect cue to talk about Ukraine here, because the border there is tense, certainly, but there is an agreement called the Minsk Agreement, which has really calmed down things greatly. And I wanted to play this to you, Anthony, because I was so shocked to hear on the World Service that BBC's Jonah Fisher talking about an interesting event which took place last weekend, which was the splitting of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church from the Orthodox Church in general. So they're going to have their own independent Orthodox Church. But he said something which was, I thought, incredible, which is that effectively Russia and Ukraine are at war, which they're not. And also he talks, the interesting part of his report, he talks about the potential problems with the Russian Orthodox Church. You have lots of monasteries still right across Ukraine, and that they may be deliberately shut down or closed down by the Ukrainian government. So let's have a listen to Jonah Fisher now and see if you laughed as much as I did when I heard him talk about this so-called war going on between Ukraine and Russia.
Petro Poroshenko, the Ukrainian president, is there. He is clearly keen to use this moment of victory for all it's worth. There's an election due here in 3 months' time, and he's doing badly in the opinion poll. So he is no doubt hoping that placing himself at the centre of this will boost his own political prospects. I think if we ask ourselves the question, why is this happening now, we have to look at the fact that effectively Russia and Ukraine are at war with each other. 4 years ago, Russia seized Crimea from Ukraine, and at this very moment in time, a war is continuing in eastern Ukraine in which rebels that are being backed by Russia are fighting the Ukrainian army. So I think both on the global level, in terms of what other countries thought about Ukraine having its own independent church, that helped push us to this moment. And domestically here in Ukraine as well, I think many people who perhaps didn't have a strong feeling about whether Ukraine's church should be officially recognized or not, the conflict in the east in particular, I think, has driven many people and pushed public opinion here to feel that the time had really come for Ukraine to complete that breakaway and to have its own fully independent and fully recognized Orthodox Church. What happens to the churches and monasteries here which remain under the control of the Russian Orthodox Church? There are about 12,000 parishes which are controlled by the Russian Orthodox Church. As part of this decision, they don't simply get swapped over and handed over to this newly independent Ukrainian Orthodox Church. There are many people here who would, of course, like that to happen, but they do remain under the control of the Russian Orthodox Church for now. I think what people are concerned about is that perhaps there might be moves made to take over these monasteries by force. There might be efforts made to push out the monks, the priests from the Russian Orthodox Church. And if that does happen, well, there is, of course, the potential for conflict. And, of course, there is also the potential that Russia may feel particularly insulted by any move in that way. And in a sort of worst case scenario, they might feel, Moscow might feel that it might have to intervene in some way to protect these churches that are controlled by the Russian Orthodox Church.
Well, the last half of his report was quite good. Fascinating, actually. But that was Jonah Fisher from the BBC giving fake news, Anthony, of a ongoing war between between Russia and Ukraine. Now, what do you think is the reality of the situation there? He's talking about Russia having seized Crimea.
Well, Crimea was, the basis of the Russian Navy, the important transit point. It's very connected to Russia. The majority of people in Crimea want to be part of Russia. Was it Khrushchev attached Crimea to Ukraine in 1954 in some inexplicable action? What I focused in on was, suddenly this emphasis on the Byzantine Church and the various branches of the Byzantine Church, and would there be a Ukrainian Byzantine Church? That's part of the era of the global war on terror, the post-9/11 era. We in the 20th century, we were becoming more and more secular. But suddenly this 9/11 had built into its sort of propaganda structure all this emphasis on religion. And this grew out of the Clash of Civilizations thesis by Samuel Huntington, which put all this emphasis on religion. So using religion as a tactic of propaganda, as a
I'll tell you what I think it is. I think he's absolutely desperate. He's only at 8% in the polls, and he'd try anything in order to get a bit of sympathy. But look, listen, before we finish at the top of the hour, Anthony, I must play you a little clip from Bernie Sanders this week, and let's just finish on looking at Trump on the wall, because the distraction technique seems to be what Trump is up to here. So let's have a listen to... He's the guy who ran against Hillary Clinton, who was robbed of the Democratic nomination. So many people say, including our own Martin Summers here on many occasions, has said Bernie Sanders, really, if there was any real democracy in the United States, should be the president right now. So this is his reaction to the Oval Office speech about the wall.
Thank you very much for joining me this evening. President Trump has stated tonight and over again in recent weeks that this country faces a national emergency. Well, he's right. But it is an emergency and a crisis that he himself has created. As we speak, some 800,000 federal employees, people who are our neighbors, friends, and family members, are going without pay. As working people, many of them are wondering how they will pay their mortgages, how they will feed their kids, and how they'll be able to go to the doctor. These are the people in the FBI, in the TSA, in the State Department, in the Treasury Department, and other agencies who have, in some cases, worked for the federal government for decades. Let me just quote what one federal employee has said. Just one, quote, "I am a single mom and a federal employee. I have $100 to last me, and my vehicle payments will not be made this month. I live paycheck to paycheck, and I can't get a side job because I still have to go to my unpaid federal job," end of quote. And she speaks for thousands of federal employees. Our federal employees deserve to be treated with respect, not held hostage as political pawns. Further, if this government shutdown continues, and Trump has indicated that he is prepared to shut it down for months, if not years, millions of Americans, including the disabled, the children, and the elderly, may not be able to get the food stamps they need to eat. Pregnant mothers and their babies may go without the nutrition assistance they need to stay healthy, as the WIC program is on the verge of running out of money. Small businesses and farmers will not be able to receive the financial assistance they need, and some may go out of business. Security at our nation's airports could be threatened if TSA employees and air control traffic controllers are not getting paid. People who are buying or selling their homes may see significant delays because the Federal Housing Administration is unable to process and approve mortgage applications. Let me be as clear as I can be. This shutdown should never have happened. As many of you will recall, on December 19th, the U.S. Senate voted unanimously to keep the government open. Unanimously, no Democrat or Republican opposed the bill that passed the Senate. It was widely expected that the following morning, December 20th, the House would do the same and the government would remain open. Unfortunately, President Trump, who started receiving criticism from an assortment of right-wing ideologues, changed his mind about the agreement and said that he would not sign any bill unless it included $5.7 billion for a wall on the southern border. And by the way, the total cost of that wall could run as high as $70 billion. In terms of this shutdown, President Trump has made it very clear who is responsible. As you will all recall, in a very public meeting he held in the Oval Office, he said, and I quote, This is quoting Donald Trump. Quote, I am proud to shut down the government. I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you, Chuck Schumer, for it. End of quote. On January 3rd, 2019, on their first day in the majority, the Democrats in the House passed legislation to reopen the government. This was exactly the same bill unanimously passed by the Senate. Tonight, I urge Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to allow that bill to come to the floor for a vote. This is the same bill that Mr. McConnell supported when it was unanimously passed in the Senate. Senator McConnell, let's vote to end this shutdown now in a bipartisan way. President Trump tonight has told us why he believes we need the wall. It gives me no pleasure to tell you what most of you already know, and that is that President Trump lies all of the time. And in his remarks tonight and in recent weeks regarding immigration and the wall, he continues to lie. Just a few examples. Trump has told the American people several hundred times, and he mentioned it tonight, that Mexico would pay for the wall. That's a lie. If this wall were to be built, Mexico would not pay for it. American taxpayers would. Trump said that thousands and thousands of terrorists are entering the United States from the southern border. That is also a lie. According to a State Department report released in September, quote, at year's end, there was no credible evidence indicating that international terrorist groups have sent operatives via Mexico into the United States, end of quote. That's not Bernie Sanders' opinion. That is a direct quote from Trump's own State Department. Trump recently said that some ex-presidents told him that they should have built a wall. That is a lie. All four living ex-presidents have stated clearly that they never talked to Trump about their desire to build a wall. Trump said that we need a wall to prevent heroin, fentanyl, and other illegal drugs from coming into the country. Another lie. According to Donald Trump's own Drug Enforcement Administration, the most common method Mexican cartels use to transport illegal drugs over the southwest border is through legal ports of entry using passenger vehicles. And on it goes. In terms of immigration in this country, what we need to do is not to waste billions of dollars on a wall, but to finally address the need for comprehensive immigration reform, including improved border security. It is inhumane that tiny children at the border have been torn away from their parents. It is disgraceful that 1.8 million young people raised in the United States and who know no other country but the United States have lost their legal protection under the DACA program because of Trump's actions. It is heartbreaking that almost 11 million undocumented people living in this country, the overwhelming majority of whom are hardworking and law-abiding, worry every day about being deported and separated from their loved ones. Sadly, what President Trump is trying to do is to create fear and hatred in our country. Instead of trying to bring us together as a people, he is trying to divide us up. And in the process, divert our attention away from the real crises facing the working families of this nation. President Trump, you want to talk about crises? At a time of massive income and wealth inequality, tens of millions of our workers are earning starvation wages and are unable to adequately provide for their families. That's a crisis. You want to talk about a national emergency? 30 million Americans have no health insurance, and many more are underinsured. Thousands die each year because they don't go to a doctor when they should. And our life expectancy in this country is actually in decline. While the pharmaceutical industry makes tens of billions of dollars a year in profit, one in five Americans can't afford the medicine they need. Now that is a crisis we should be working on right now. And here's another crisis. Too many of our seniors are living in desperate poverty, and about half of older Americans have no retirement savings. Hundreds of thousands of young people cannot afford to go to college in this country, and over 40 million are trying to deal with the outrageous levels of student debt they are experiencing. What are we going to do about those crises? And maybe here's the biggest crisis of all. The scientific community has made it very clear in telling us that climate change is real and is causing devastating harm to our country and the entire planet. And they have told us, in no uncertain terms, that if we do not transform our energy system away from fossil fuel, our nation and our planet, and the planet we will be leaving our kids and grandchildren, may well become unhealthy and even uninhabitable in the not-so-distant future. Mr. President, we don't need to create artificial crises. We have enough real crises. Let us end this shutdown and bring the American people together around an agenda that will improve life for all of our people.
So that's Bernie Sanders' reaction to Trump's Oval Office speech. Anthony Hall, what do you make there?
Well, I think this is an indicator of this kind of dark age that we've fallen into, and this divide and conquer, you know, making the wall, a symbol of division between peoples, the basis of a historic
the shutdown, though? Isn't this actually just making no government, which is kind of what the Republicans want anyway? The idea really being to hand over the government to big business and the banksters.
Well, there's that, but let's remember, in the global war on terror, big government is listening to us, spying on us, spending all kinds of money to do war. I mean, Republicans...
Sorry, we have to leave it there. Anthony, we're going to have to leave it there. Time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. That was Professor Anthony Hall, author of Earth into Property, Colonization, Decolonization and Capitalism. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend.
Donald Trump is deemed to be a righteous man because he's serving the political agenda of the Christian right. And Mike Pence, by his presence on the ticket, signaled to everyone who had ears to hear that it was okay to vote for this guy who had all these affairs and who spoke in this awful way and denigrated people. And he affirmed for everyone that I've got this. You know, I'm going to keep an eye on him and make sure that he does right by the world.
Vice President Mike Pence has been tasked with negotiating with congressional Democrats and trying to end the government shutdown. Today, we are going to be in conversation about the history of Mike Pence and perhaps what his role is in the administration. My guest is Michael D'Antonio. Michael D'Antonio is a longtime journalist and author of the book, The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence. That's next on Letters in Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. President Donald Trump travels to McAllen, Texas at the southern border to dramatize his insistence that Democrats agree to his $5.7 billion demand for an expanded border wall. He spoke briefly with reporters and repeated his threat to go over the heads of lawmakers and declare a national emergency to obtain the funds.
I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. The lawyers have so advised me. I'm not prepared to do that yet, but if I have to, I will. I have no doubt about it. I will. I have the absolute right to declare this was passed by Congress. I haven't done it yet. I may do it. If this doesn't work out, probably I will do it. I would almost say definitely.
Trump also said China is easier to deal with and much more honorable than Democratic congressional leaders Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. Trump walked out of a meeting with the two yesterday after just 14 minutes. Pelosi this morning called Trump obstinate and petulant.
And if you believe in your arguments and you're convinced that you're right and you think you can persuade others, you don't have to shut down government to strengthen your hand.
Federal workers and supporters were rallying in Washington, D.C. and cities around the country calling for an end to the partial shutdown. Maryland Senator Ben Cardin addressed the Washington crowd.
This shutdown is outrageous, it's dangerous, and it has to end now.
Northern California Republican Congressman Doug LaMalfa says President Trump's threat to cut off FEMA funding to California wildfire victims is not helpful. Trump tweeted yesterday that poor forest management is to blame for California's deadly wildfires and said he'd ordered the federal emergency management agencies to stop giving the state money unless they get their act together. Trump's statement came despite the fact that the federal government itself manages 57% of forests in California, the state just 2%. LaMalfa said threats to FEMA funding are not helpful and will not solve the longer-term forest management regulatory problems. California Governor Gavin Newsom said Californians affected by wildfires should not be victims to partisan bickering. Billionaire, investor, environmentalist, and Democratic activist Tom Steyer announced he will not run for the White House in 2020 and will instead focus on calling for President Trump's impeachment. Steyer has spent $50 million on his Need to Impeach campaign and announced plans to spend $40 million more this year. He said at an event in Des Moines that most people come to Iowa around this time to announce a campaign for the presidency. Steyer said he was announcing he'll do whatever it takes for as long as it takes to remove a president.
I'm willing to do whatever I can to protect our country from this reckless, lawless, and dangerous president. Now the impeachment question has reached an inflection point. Therefore, I will be dedicating 100% of my time, effort, and resources to one cause, working for Mr. Trump's impeachment and removal from office.
Steyer said his $40 million commitment for 2019 was designed to pressure the democratically controlled House to begin impeachment hearings and to persuade the party's presidential contenders to support impeachment in their platforms. The union representing teachers in Los Angeles has postponed the start of a possible strike until Monday because of uncertainty over whether a judge would order a delay. United Teachers Los Angeles previously said its 35,000 members would walk off the job today for their first strike in 30 years. But a judge was considering whether the union gave proper notice in announcing the possible strike and could have ordered teachers to wait. Negotiations continued yesterday over the key issues of higher pay and smaller class sizes in the nation's second largest school district. The district educates 640,000 Los Angeles school children. Congo's powerful Catholic Church is challenging the surprise win of opposition leader Felix Tshisekedi in the presidential election. The church says the official results don't match the outcome compiled by its 40,000 observers at all polling stations around the country. The church didn't say publicly who it believed really won, but diplomats briefed on its findings said opposition leader Martin Fayulu won easily. Fayulu alleges that President Joseph Kabila engineered a backroom deal with the largely untested Tshisekedi in order to thwart anti-corruption efforts in a country with vast mineral wealth. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we're going to be in conversation about the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence. My guest is Michael D'Antonio. Michael D'Antonio is a veteran journalist. He has co-won the Pulitzer Prize for local reporting. He has written several books, including The Truth About Trump, and he is now the author of a new book about Mike Pence, which is called The Shadow President. The Truth About Mike Pence. It is co-written with Peter Eisner. Michael D'Antonio, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Happy to be with you.
You call Mike Pence perhaps the most successful Christian supremacist in the history of the country. First, what is meant by Christian supremacist?
Well, we see that identity as being someone who's devoted to imposing their view of biblical values on the body politic and really on Americans across the country from coast to coast and of every sort. So this is an idea that's percolated in American politics really since the mid-19th century. A lot of folks want to say that it goes back to the founding, but it doesn't really. There weren't people with this ideology agitating in the way that we see them today back during the founding. And it's a devotion to the end of reproductive rights of all sorts, not just the access to abortion, but in Pence's case, I think he's opposed to many forms of contraception. This is something that the Christian right movement toys with often. You know, they don't want people to know this, but it is part of their agenda. Support for Israel, no matter what, is another element of this Christian supremacy, and people get confused by this because they think, well, Jews and Christians sometimes seem opposed, but the Christian right's affinity for Israel has a lot to do with the fulfillment of what they imagine to be an end times prophecy. So there are a lot of things one might not expect, like devotion to gun rights and an extreme version of gun rights. In that context, the Second Amendment becomes almost like one of the Ten Commandments and is very much what people identify in Christian American circles as a God-given right. And Mike is really the most successful politician of this sort. No previous person with this orientation has reached the vice presidency, and there have been very few senators who share those views. So we're safe saying he's reached the heights for this subculture of political Christians.
What I find interesting, and you mentioned and kind of debunked this issue that this goes back, the Christian supremacy to the founders, and it was always there, is that these issues you talk about are very, very modern ones, reproductive issues, all these things are – this is a very modern movement.
It is. Now, another one is school prayer, and there were no public schools in most places in 1776, and school prayer was outlawed after World War II, but there is this sense that somehow – God has been removed from the public square in the modern era, and it is really a backlash kind of movement. So there's a sense that somehow our side is losing. And there's another part of it that I think is fascinating that Mike really does subscribe to as well, and it's a kind of victimology where conservative Christians believe that they are victims of a dominant culture that isn't theirs, so that they imagine themselves to be suffering and outcasts, almost like the Jews of the biblical era. The fact that a lot of them live in mini mansions and have big swimming pools and live quite well is doesn't dissuade them from feeling that they're suffering and that somehow they need to take their country back. And Mike Pence is very much of a mind to take the country back in the way that this movement expresses it.
When we say this movement, we're talking about evangelicals. Is that correct?
Yes, but it's not all evangelical Christians. And that's another thing that people are confused about, and that the Christian right profits by this confusion. There are many younger evangelicals especially, but also evangelicals who are more moderate in their views, who don't subscribe to the blend of politics and religion that Mike represents. So the Ralph Reed, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson style of faith and religion is not universally embraced by evangelicals, and it's actually being challenged in a lot of circles. Environmental issues are really important to younger evangelicals. They think that climate change is real. They think that Christians are called to be good stewards of the earth, and there is a pushback taking place. So it's not a monolith.
You write in the book, The Shadow President, that Pence and people like him in this movement, they see themselves, and you referred to this earlier, as the modern-day Israelites. And you also mentioned his devotion to Israel itself. Is there a connection in that way?
There is, and this is the thing that's evolved really since the 1970s. It is also a new phenomenon. And what happened was guys like Jerry Falwell wanted to make common cause with American Jews and also Israelis because they felt that the Bible commanded them to. They recognized Jews as the chosen people, but they also thought that they had a winning political issue. American support for Israel has always been very strong, and when you think about problems related to terrorism and Islam, there's a natural affinity for, especially some people on the right, to say, well, we're going to embrace this, the Israelis as our allies. They are sort of on the front lines when it comes to terrorism, and there is a prejudice and bigotry directed toward Muslims, and it's almost a natural fit. But also, you know, this religiously, this idea that Jews are chosen is very attractive to evangelicals and conservative Christians who want to feel chosen themselves. And they think that come the end times, and by that they mean, you know, the time when the Antichrist will appear, and these are all things that they think are literally going to happen, that the Antichrist will appear. It might be Hillary Clinton. It might be Barack Obama. They've speculated that all sorts of people are the Antichrist, and that there will be a battle of good and evil, that the righteous will be lifted into heaven, and that may include Jews who are raised from the dead, and that God's 1,000-year reign on earth will commence. And this is something that animates people's lives, and Mike believes in it. His attachment to Israel has something to do with the role that he expects Israel to play in this prophecy. And he imagines, and so do many of these believers, that American Christians are very much like the Jews of old and could be considered to be the equivalent today.
Let's get into Mike Pence's attachment to the president of the United States, Donald Trump, which obviously to many people appears odd if you just look at Donald Trump's background, and never mind now we know of his affairs with adult film actors. But what I found fascinating is, and I get this from your book, is that Mike Pence sees Donald Trump and maybe other evangelicals as well as a vehicle for them, as one that was assigned by God. If you really look at what they think, it's not as contradictory as it may look on the outside.
Precisely. I mean, this is the concept that Trump is a broken vessel that is nevertheless useful to God and can actually carry the message of conservative Christianity forward and serve the Christian ideal as they imagine it to be, even though he's a very profane and fallen person. And this is a justification that people use as they talk about Donald Trump, and it explains why there are so many conservative Christian voters who are really attached to the president. They are going to go down with the ship. If Donald Trump is driven from office, I think they'll still be devoted to him, still feel that he was railroaded and that he was put in place by the hand of God to fulfill a purpose. And, you know, when you start to think that everything is preordained, and Mike Pence definitely feels that things are preordained and governed by God, then you can retrofit everything that happens to fit your perspective. So in the case of the election of a Democrat, for example, that might be interpreted as God issuing a reproach to the faithful. It might be that God is demonstrating that he's not happy with the sin in the church and in the American people and is punishing them by delivering them to a Democrat. And then when a Republican is elected, that's evidence of God's favor. And, you know, there are forces of good and evil at work in the world, and that it is almost the devil incarnate manipulating things when bad things happen. But when good things occur by their interpretation, then God is behind it. So they think Donald Trump is someone ordained or predestined to be president and is going to bring us one step closer to the time when Christians will dominate all of life in really around the world.
And it's not that Mike Pence and other evangelicals are oblivious to the shortcomings of Donald Trump, but they're even able to look and find stories within the Bible of other examples of extremely troubled leaders who are still able to fulfill some kind of a task in order to fulfill God's will.
Yeah, so this would be Cyrus in the Old Testament, a non-Jewish king who protected the Jews and worked through Jewish emissaries to promote their welfare and was therefore deemed righteous. And so Donald Trump is deemed to be a righteous man because he's serving the political agenda of the Christian right. And Mike Pence, by his presence on the ticket, signaled to everyone who had ears to hear that it was okay to vote for this guy who had all these affairs and who spoke in this awful way and denigrated people. And he affirmed for everyone that I've got this. You know, I'm going to keep an eye on him and make sure that he does right by the world. And, you know, Trump himself made little overtures to the Christian right and is embraced by them because he's appointed people they favor. Betsy DeVos is one of theirs. So is Ben Carson. They're just you can go throughout the administration and see people put in place who are powerfully appealing to evangelicals and also have a direct connection to Mike Pence. And these are all people that they trust And it's good politics for Donald Trump. And as far as the Christian right is concerned, it's good religion.
I have to tell you something. I am an enthusiast of classical history, and I never had thought about the comparison of Donald Trump to Cyrus the Great.
Well, right. But, you know, they find these examples everywhere, and it's a way of retrofitting reality to suit their needs. You know, and this is what's really fascinating, I think, about Mike Pence, too. He ran for office twice before the race in 2000 when he finally got elected to Congress. And in those races, he behaved pretty awfully. You know, he lied about his opponent. He ran attack ads. And what he took away from his failure then was that he hadn't been true to his faith, and that he needed to sort of retreat and study and figure out what he really wanted. And he spent about a decade in talk radio, of all places. A lot of people don't know that Mike Pence was in the media before Donald Trump was. You know, Trump wasn't the host of The Apprentice until the mid-2000s, and Pence had been a media guy ever since 1990. And when he ran again in 2000 and prevailed, it was as a more sophisticated, quieter, he called himself conservative but not angry about it. And it worked. It persuaded enough people who were moderates and independents in Indiana to back him, but also the conservative Christians who were dominant in his district understood that he went to the right church, he said the right things, and could be trusted as well.
This is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation with Michael D'Antonio. He's a veteran journalist, author of several books. His latest, which is co-written with Peter Eisner, is called The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence. It is what we are in conversation about. Michael D'Antonio, when we think of the vice president and we think of elections, and there's always, you know, right around the conventions, just before the conventions, a candidate will announce who their vice presidential candidate will be. And there's always a lot of interest in it because, you know, that's how politics works, how the news media works. But rarely do we see that you may have an influential vice president, as Dick Cheney was to George W. Bush. But rarely do you see a vice president, really a candidate anyways, be influential on how the vote turns out in the end. Yet I get the sense that this may be one of the exceptions with Mike Pence in order to get Donald Trump that evangelical vote. This might be one of the most consequential vice presidential candidate picks in modern history.
I think you're right. And we didn't quite nail it down as specifically as you have right there, but you're absolutely correct. I think that Dick Cheney did not bring anything to the Bush ticket that Bush didn't have already. He might have persuaded a few more militant conservatives that Bush was okay, but I don't think there was a big block that he brought with him. And certainly Al Gore didn't do anything for Bill Clinton that Clinton didn't do for himself. And you can go back a long way and still not find a vice president who was as important when people finally went to vote as Mike Pence was. Barack Obama won Indiana in 2008. That's Mike Pence's home state. I think that a lot of states where evangelicals matter went for Trump because of Pence. And I don't think that Trump would have prevailed in the election. You know, as it was, of course, he didn't win the popular vote. He lost it by about 3 million. And you could have swung the election the other way with a stadium full of voters who chose Clinton over Trump. But they nevertheless won the Electoral College, and they won it in states where evangelicals really matter. You know, Florida is one of those places. Michigan is important. And people don't, outside of the Midwest, don't understand that Michigan and Wisconsin are places where a certain kind of conservative evangelical faith is very important to the election results in, every year, every 4 years. It matters who gets that evangelical vote in those states.
You mentioned some other administration officials like Betsy DeVos, Ben Carson. You also write about in the book, Alex Azar. I mean, these are basically Pence people. I mean, do we have a situation where there is a significant number of people in the administration who we would consider to be these are Pence's people? And how did that come about? How did he make that happen?
Well, when Trump was elected, he was as surprised as anybody.
Yeah.
The one who was prepared to staff up the administration was Pence. So Tom Price was one of his people. Sonny Perdue was one of his people. These are two cabinet members. Rick Perry is a Pence guy. There are just very many people, not only at the cabinet level, but especially at levels two or three rungs below, who were more committed to Mike Pence than Donald Trump. And he has himself a national organization that is quite deep of supporters and donors. During his time in Congress from 2000 to 2012, Pence raised enormous amounts of money. He was one of the big money raisers on the Republican side of the aisle, and gave a lot of that money away because he was so strong in his own district that he didn't need to spend it. So his PAC funded all kinds of campaigns, and those people became loyal to him. So there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people in the federal bureaucracy who owe their allegiance more to Pence than to Trump. And that's even true when it comes to people appointed to the bench. Pence's office has played a substantial role in the vetting of candidates, not only for federal district courts, but also appeals courts and to the Supreme Court. People like Gorsuch and Kavanaugh are people that Pence's side of things approve of very much, and he would have weighed in on their favor.
This is so interesting because there's this iconic moment recently at the White House between Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, and Donald Trump, where they, in front of cameras, get into like a 10-15 minute argument. Also in that room, who you really never hear from, is Mike Pence, who's just sitting there meekly and looking very ineffective. And sometimes he comes off that way. But it sounds like what you're saying here is that he's much more of an important factor that gets his way within this White House.
He's very important. But that public persona that he presents whenever Trump is around is essential to his success in the administration, because the surest way to run afoul of Donald Trump is to steal the spotlight. And
that's right.
And there is a lot in Mike's background that we discovered that prepared him to play this role of sycophant in chief. You know, he really is the guy most associated with this kind of craven collapse in front of Trump's ego. And he never expresses a disagreement. He barely speaks when they're together. But that's how you get Donald Trump to leave you alone, to do the things you want to do. And it's how you get him to trust you. And Pence is very much trusted in Trump's world. I think he was preferred by Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump when the vice president spot was nailed down. They didn't want Chris Christie in the job, and he was the other leading candidate. And he's navigated things very well. So he doesn't have the respect of those who aren't inclined to favor Republicans anyway. You know, there's that famous scene of him sitting at the cabinet table with Trump and all the members of the cabinet, going on and on and on, praising him. I think he expressed gratitude for Trump 14 different ways in the space of 3 minutes. And he actually talked about serving with Trump being the most important thing ever to happen to him, as if his marriage and the arrival of his children were somehow second to being Trump's vice president. But he's willing to do it. And you know, Paul Begala once said to me that a politician never stands so tall as when he stoops to kiss somebody's you-know-what. And I think, you know, Mike Pence knows how to stand tall in that way, and he's happy to do it. And it's undignified and makes many of us cringe, but it's how you get along with Donald Trump, and it's how you maintain your own power within his administration.
Well, you also write about that moment. I think it's about that moment. I don't have it right in front of me, so if I get this at all wrong, you'll correct me. But at the end of praising Donald Trump, that again, another sort of iconic moment when all these members of his cabinet are sort of going around the table and praising him, and Mike Pence begins this whole process. Wasn't like, as Trump is saying, "Thank you, Mike, that means a lot to me," then Pence throws in some kind of religious saying or homage to God that I think you interpreted as a signal to other evangelicals.
Oh, yes. He asked God to bless Donald Trump. And this is what prompted George Will, hardly a raging liberal, to call Mike Pence America's most repulsive public figure. You know, he just can't stop praising Trump, calling attention to his greatness, and really putting himself in the shadows. And, you know, that's another reason why we call him the shadow president. Is some of this, I think, is designed by Pence to deflect attention from himself. He goes around the country much more than Donald Trump does, giving speeches and raising money. We estimate that Pence is gone about 3 out of 4 weeks of every month doing some event to raise money for some PAC or another and to get the faithful energized on behalf of Trump's reelection. And he's able to do this and sort of fly under the radar because no one thinks he matters. But the Trump show is so distracting. You know, you've got one guy over here throwing confetti around and falling on his keister, and you've got Mike Pence going in the other direction, quietly raising huge sums of money and telling people it's all going great. You're going to have to reelect us in 2020. And what he's really doing is preparing for Trump's demise. You know, Mike Pence's end game is to be president himself.
He wants to be president.
Oh, most definitely. He's wanted to be president since he was 13 or 14 years old, and he's expressed it beginning then to anyone who would listen.
What do we have? Where did you find that?
Oh, well, he did that in high school. He told friends, and we met some of them who remembered him saying, "I'm going to be president one day." And by the time he was in college, he was letting people know that he thought that God intended him to be president. Now, this is shocking to my ear, but it wouldn't be to someone who's guided by faith in the way that many of Pence's supporters and many of the president's supporters are. They believe that they hear the voice of God guiding them as well. And so it's not hubris. It's not some kind of fantasy to say that I think this is God's plan for me. if your faith moves you to believe it. And I think Mike has believed it for a very long time.
I'm going to quote from your book here. It's just in the introduction, and this is about a quote. Well, another quote that is very important from the Bible for Mike Pence. Anyways, I'm quoting from your book. Believers who assume that God chooses winners and losers before they are born typically cite a verse from the Bible's book of Jeremiah. Quote, "For I know the plans I have for you, declared the Lord, plans no prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future." The verse is Pence's favorite bit of scripture and is written on a plaque he hung over the fireplace in the vice president's residence in Washington. So he has this up in up in the vice president's place.
Well, and this is you know, it's a bit of Calvinism, you know, a bit of classic early Protestant belief that God does pick winners and losers, and actually a person's wealth, according to this theology, is an indicator of God's favor. So people who are very rich, who are very famous, who are very powerful, that's evidence that they're living with as little sin as possible and that God wants them to have all those things. And conversely, if you're poor, if you're powerless, if terrible things have fallen upon you, that's God's doing as well. And you must not be right with God. And, you know, that's a dangerous, I think, way to approach your fellow human being. It kind of takes everything out of an individual's hands and puts all of it in God's hands. And the potential for abuse there is great. If you think that your power comes from God, what's to constrain you? And if you believe that God is working through you and you have the impulse to separate children from their mothers at the border, or that somehow there were good people on both sides in Charlottesville, well, then God is telling you the truth. And you can do just about anything. And I think that's something that chills a lot of us.
Michael D'Antonio, in your book that you co-wrote with Peter Eisner, it's called The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence, you say and you write that Mike Pence had specifically positioned himself early on in his career very well in order to benefit from this kind of marriage within conservative politics between Christian conservatives and economic libertarians. Tell me about that dynamic.
Well, this is something that people who know about the Koch brothers machine, you know, this vast number of funding mechanisms that they created to funnel hundreds of millions of dollars into political causes would understand. You know, so the Kochs are not particularly religious, but they're very libertarian, and they believe that there should be almost no regulation of American business. They're opposed to environmental regulations and really would like to see the government reduced to national defense, the judiciary, and maybe the highways. I think they like the highways because it allows them to ship their oil around. But other than that, they'd like there to be no government. And they were having trouble breaking through in elections because that libertarian movement is too small to capture most offices. So there was a period in the 1990s when a common cause was made with the Christian right. And the Kochs, who don't tolerate religion very well, sort of held their nose and decided, well, we're going to go for some of these votes. And Mike became one of their early recipients of their largesse. He got thousands and thousands of dollars from the Kochs for his very first campaign. And there were others like Jeff Flake, then later Paul Ryan. They t- tended to pick these guys who looked pretty good and spoke well, but held to the libertarian view of government and could use religion also to appeal to a broader base. And Mike was absolutely in the sweet spot and got both groups behind him. He was so radical when it came to his economic ideas that he argued in his first campaign in 2000 that there was no real connection between smoking and cancer, so there should be no regulation of tobacco. This is a pretty stunning thing for someone to say in the year 2000, but he really advocated this idea. And he was very much against strict environmental regulations without telling people that his family business had dumped a lot of petroleum products into the ground in Indiana and was being pursued by the state of Indiana to clean it up. He also had his own experience with bankruptcy. That company that the Pence family owned and operated went bankrupt to the tune of $100 million, which in 2005 in Indiana was one of the biggest bankruptcies the state had ever seen. So Mike is not as unfamiliar with the kinds of things Donald Trump is known for as you might imagine.
You also do an interesting, just on the line of the same thought, compare and contrast with Daryl Issa, a former Republican member of Congress who retired, I think seeing that he wasn't going to win his re-election bid anyways. And the interesting thing there is sort of their career Daryl Issa obviously didn't make it to the White House, but in some ways their political careers have mirrored each other, except Daryl Issa was much more secular than Mike Pence was. And of course, it's Daryl Issa who ends up out of Congress now.
Well, it's fascinating because at one point Issa would have been considered so far to the right that he was barely in the mainstream. And yet he, in contrast with Pence, was actually a successful business person. He came to Congress and did quite well, rising to committee chairmanship, and was very, very visible, as people know, as a pursuer of Hillary Clinton during the whole Benghazi nonsense. But he, as a secular fellow, as a person who didn't emphasize his Christian right bona fides, gradually receded in prominence. And he is gone from Congress, and Pence is now the vice president. And it tells you a lot about where the party has moved. There are a great many Republicans who have left the party because they are uncomfortable with this religious extremism. And they were economic conservatives, but not religious conservatives, and now find themselves really without a party to call home.
Before being vice president, Mike Pence was former governor of Indiana. And then before that, he served some 12 years or so in the United States House of Representatives as a Republican representative from Congress. 10 years ago, I was a congressional correspondent, and I remember seeing Mike Pence around. I remember going to when the Republican leadership in the House would have their press conferences, and they'd have their whole leadership team there. And Mike Pence was a part of that leadership team. So Mike Pence would be there. He never said anything. And I remember sitting there and thinking quite frequently, how did this guy even get into the leadership? He doesn't do anything.
It was the money that he was raising.
Huh.
You know, that's the thing that a lot of us aren't quite aware of as we're looking at the political parties and wondering, well, who decided that this guy Pence, for example, should be rewarded with a leadership position? And a lot of representatives felt that they owed him something, that he had not only given them money directly, but he'd visit districts and raise money at events for them. He was very presentable. You know, he had a good voice. He looks pretty reasonable. Some people think he's kind of good looking. And he does, what's funny about him is he does have a sense of humor. You know, on his radio show, he would always have these bumpers. And many of them were these self-deprecating jokes. One of them was, you know, and now the fellow who would have been the new James Bond, if only his mother had let him. And that, you know, certainly we're never going to hear Donald Trump make fun of himself that way.
Yeah.
But Mike could do that. He was personable and well-liked. But you're correct. He never really did anything in the House. I don't think he ever sponsored a bill, was the original sponsor of a bill that got passed. He was so ineffective as a legislator that when he devised a bill on child pornography, he couldn't even get that passed. And if you can't get people to vote for your bill that's opposing child pornography, then you really aren't working very hard as a Republican.
Well, do you know why he couldn't get it passed? I mean, maybe he went too far on it. Maybe he was trying to implicate people who shouldn't have been implicated.
Sure. But I think that shows that he had a tin ear when it came to policymaking. And this came through loud and clear when he was governor of Indiana. He really struggled to get things done. And when he made bold moves, they often backfired. The biggest one being his religious freedom initiative, where it was a state version of a federal proposal that permitted people to discriminate on the basis of religious belief. And when it was passed, people didn't quite understand how it would be implemented. And when it became clear that it would permit businesses to discriminate against gay people specifically, the local business community just exploded. They were so outraged. They thought that this was terrible for Indiana, terrible for especially Indianapolis as a big city that liked to attract conventions and basketball tournaments. And there were teams in the NCAA that declared they wouldn't go to Indiana to play games anymore. And by the time they were done, Pence was backtracking on it and revising it. And it was made into a toothless law. And that was his big achievement as governor. That was supposed to be an expression of his true values. And he misjudged what Hoosiers were willing to put up with in the name of religious faith.
Does this mean he can compromise and back down?
Oh, I think he can. I think he wants to win. I think in that case, he was recognizing that this was the donor class that was up in arms. And he knew these people very well. One of the things that he did that was very cagey when he was out of politics was he featured the business elite of Indiana on his radio and TV shows. So he would identify the richest people, the most powerful executives, bring his cameras to their homes or host them at a dinner.
Michael D'Antonio, in our few remaining minutes together here, let's talk about some of the influences on Mike Pence throughout his life. And, you know, when we think of mentors, at least with, say, the president, Donald Trump, we usually think of Roy Cohn, who was one time the right-hand man to Joseph McCarthy. A real reputation for being a tough guy and influential on Donald Trump. For Michael Pence, you write about Charles Colson. Who is Charles Colson?
Boy, Chuck Colson was one of Nixon's henchmen in the Watergate era and was convicted and went to prison and came out and transformed himself into a evangelical preacher whose ministry was focused primarily on prisons, but he was a very avid public speaker. He retained his strong conservative views, but then melded them with evangelical faith. And Colson, as well as Dobson, the head of Focus on the Family, a highly conservative religious organization, people like Pat Robertson, the fellow who runs the Christian Coalition, Ralph Reed, these are all people that Pence would have been drawn to and would have drawn ideas from. And this is an aggressive form of Christian faith. People who think that it's not a bad idea to mix it up, and they think of the image of Christ as turning the other cheek, as being too meek and not manly enough. So there is this idea of a robust, combative Christianity that asserts itself and gets into the political arena and fights. And these were men who inspired Mike Pence. He also found himself claiming to be a Reagan Republican, although I don't think that he has Reagan's patience or sunny disposition when it comes to dealing with the opposition. There's a lot of talk and a lot has been written about Reagan and Tip O'Neill and other Democrats trying to work together. And I don't see that in Mike. I think Mike is more a man who wants to dominate if he can, wants to get 100% of what he wants. And so that would be why some of his political proposals, some of his policy ideas weren't successful. It's because I don't think that he saw the limit to his advocacy and didn't see the necessity of compromise.
Tell me about the time when he was the, I guess, the head of his fraternity in school and college, and he ratted out, I guess, his brothers at the time for drinking at a party.
Boy, this is classic Mike Pence. You know, this was a fraternity where after his freshman year, he ran for president. He was that ambitious. He not only became president of the fraternity, he also created a religious group that met in the church chapel and led that as well and preached to the students every week. So he was very engaged in promoting himself as a leader, but he wasn't very often one of the guys. So this fraternity was known for its beer blasts and showed stag films in the basement, and Mike never showed up for any of that activity. And in one of the famous episodes, one of the deans pounded on the door when he heard there was a party. And Mike opened up and said, oh, yeah, they have a keg, and let the guy in. And the fraternity was busted. They were barred from having any parties. And a couple years later, Mike was hired by the university to work in the dean's office. So there was a lot of sentiment there that, you know, Mike couldn't quite be trusted to be one of the guys, that he was too good for everybody else's benefit, you know, too good for everybody else's good. And, you know, there was another episode that he perpetrated at the fraternity that I think says a lot about Mike. And it was when he ended his friendship with a fellow student who came out to his brothers, and he was accepted by most of the other brothers. But Mike, who this young man looked up to, said, I just can't be your friend unless you change. And it really broke this guy's heart. So much so that when I talked to him decades later, he was still upset about it and couldn't understand how someone he admired, who had been his close friend, could turn his back on him in the very moment when he shared the truth about himself. But, you know, in this case,
what was the truth about himself?
Well, the truth was that he was gay.
Yeah.
So he came out to his brothers. This was the early 1980s. I guess Mike wasn't down with that at all and judged him and shunned him. And this was something that very few people, I think, would get over, and this guy never got over it, and really is perplexed by the position of power that Mike finds himself in today.
Not necessarily in thinking about the very last story that you said there concerning a friend who came out as gay and Mike Pence's response to it, but maybe the story before that about Mike Pence turning in his own fraternity brothers. Does that say anything about what we can expect, or do you think that illuminates at all what his relationship in the future may be with Donald Trump?
Oh, I think that given the choice between himself and Donald Trump, Mike would ultimately save himself. So if we suspect that he's speaking with Robert Mueller, I don't think he's lying. And that's one thing that perhaps the president isn't aware of. Mike's loyalty is strong, but it's only strong when it's in service to himself in some way. If it became clear to Mike Pence that he could be in serious trouble because of collusion with Russia or lies told to FBI agents, he's not going to be one of the people caught up in the web. He's going to tell the truth and save himself.
Michael D'Antonio has been our guest. Michael D'Antonio is a veteran journalist, and along with Peter Eisner, has written a book that we have been in conversation about. It is called The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence. Michael D'Antonio, that was interesting. I thank you greatly.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kristen Thomas is our engineer. You can find archives of our previous shows online at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I thank you for listening.
Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Ray McGovern, Russiagate, The Absence of Evidence, Part 1. The material for this program literally landed on my doorstep with a personal challenge. Would TUC Radio and you, who have listened over time, be open to hearing arguments that there is no evidence that Russia interfered in the 2016 elections? Given the speaker, former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who I met and recorded before, beginning with the opposition to the war in Iraq, and given the expertise of the group around him, the veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, and given that this group expressed their doubts about Russian interference already in December of 2016, and given that no major TV or print media have given them a voice, I picked up the challenge and am giving Ray McGovern and his colleagues this space and time, and hope that you might find his arguments and evidence as intriguing as I did. Ray McGovern served as a CIA analyst for 27 years, from the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George H.W. Bush. His duties included sharing national intelligence estimates and preparing the president's daily brief to Ronald Reagan's security advisors from 1981 to 1985. In January 2003, McGovern co-created Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS, to expose how intelligence was being falsified to justify war on Iraq. VIPS remains active to this day. McGovern was recorded on August 4, 2018 at the Common Good Cafe in Seattle, Washington. Thanks to KODX LPFM Radio for the recording. Here's Ray McGovern.
Someone came up just 15 minutes ago and said, you know, this is a really strange time. It's very disorienting. I've never seen times like this in Washington, and I've been in Washington, D.C. 55 years. She said, well, now, what are you talking about? I said, about Russiagate. And she said, oh, wow, those Russians. And I said, well, actually, what I'm going to say is that there really is not very good evidence of Russian meddling. She paled and looked and said, oh, God, what are those Trump people? I'll just add what my wife always asked me to say. My appraisal of President Trump is that he's the very worst president the United States ever had. That there are X number of reasons to indict him or to impeach him or get rid of him, not the least of which is the fact that Rita and I have 9 grandchildren who will probably not have clean air and clean water at their disposal when they get to be my age. How more serious can it be than that? I mean, what do you need to have before you impeach? You don't need made-up stuff, okay? You don't need made-up stuff. So let me just start and try to reconstruct how we got to where we are now. During the campaign in 2016, you'll remember that Hillary Clinton was accusing Donald Trump of being soft on Russia. Huh? He had this bizarre notion that it would be a good idea to have a decent relationship with Russia. Oh, God. Talk about crazy, huh? Well, Hillary and her people thought that this was something that would really resonate with the American people. Russia is bad. They would really make heyday by saying, look, Trump is soft on Russia. So they started doing that almost immediately, and then it hit the fan, literally speaking. June 12th, 2016, Julian Assange of WikiLeaks announces, we have emails related to Hillary Clinton, and we're just about to publish them. Whoa. Emails related to Hillary Clinton. This is the 12th of June. Oh, my God, the Democratic convention is just 6 weeks away. Oh, my God, I wonder what they have. And we think that the DNC knew what had been stolen. They would have the emails showing, and this is no joke, folks, showing that Hillary Clinton stole the nomination from Bernie Sanders, pure and simple. Stacked the primary, stacked all kinds of stuff, all right? So, you know, before I forget to say it, and I hope nobody take offense, if we have someone to blame for Donald Trump, you know, I mean, that's a pretty big onus, right, for Donald Trump. The Russians are, you know, easy to blame. The person responsible for us having Donald Trump is someone named Hillary Rodham Clinton. Now, she could not have lost the election because few people trusted her, or Wall Street was in her camp, or that she used an unclassified server for top secret information, or that she didn't campaign in the right states, you know. It couldn't have been that. It had to be something else. It was the Russians. Now, let me tell you how we got there. And let me just first say that this is so extraordinary. Now, everyone expected Hillary to win, right? Everyone. Well, not everybody. A couple people were smart enough to realize that this wasn't a done deal. But everyone I talked to And, you know, Julian Assange, whom I talked to 3 days before the election, said, you know, the Germans say it's eine Wahl zwischen Pest und Cholera. Anybody know German? Okay. It's a choice between plague and cholera. And it was for me. That's why I was just delighted to be able to vote for Jill Stein, okay? So what I'm saying here is that most people expected Hillary to win. The New York Times said she was a shoo-in, and everyone was operating out of that environment, including James Comey, John Brennan of the CIA, the NSA, and the Department of Justice, Loretta Lynch, and all those folk. Very high-level people, okay? Now, how do I know that? Well, you can reason to that by being an analyst, okay? But now I have documentary evidence in the form of James Comey saying, we were operating in an environment where we expected Hillary to win. Now, if you don't understand that, it's really hard for you to believe that our very top law enforcement officials and the Department of Justice, as well as the FBI, played fast and loose with the law to make sure Hillary would win and that Trump would lose. And the documentation is out there. You don't see it in the New York Times, but I'll expose you to some of it, okay? So if you don't realize that these people fully expected to keep their jobs, no small thing, fully expected to be rewarded rather than indicted by playing fast and loose with the law, then you don't understand how this kind of thing could happen. And I've not seen the like of it since Watergate, and I was around for Watergate as well. So that by way of preface to what we're going to say here. So June 12th, Assange announces that he has emails related to Hillary Clinton, was his words, and he said that he's going to publish them soon. 2 days later, CrowdStrike, the computer entity hired by the Clinton campaign, announces, we have seen an intrusion into the Democratic National Committee, and there are telltale signs in Cyrillic. Cyrillic, as most of you know, is Russian, right? Okay. As a matter of fact, we have the name of the first head of the Soviet secret police, his name and patronymic, Felix Ermundovich, which is for Dzerzhinsky, the first thing. So whoever intruded into the DNC was either incredibly sloppy, and no one has accused the GRU, the Russian military intelligence service, of being sloppy, or they were overly clever in leaving more than just telltale signs in Cyrillic, not leaving just a tablet or a Microsoft-type format, but leaving, so he wouldn't miss it, the name and patronymic Felix Ermundovich. So that's June 14th, 2 days after Julian Assange announces he's got these emails. January 15th, out of the ashes arises an entity, a persona, named Guccifer 2.0. Who is Guccifer 2.0? We don't know. A year and 1 month ago, we asked the president to find out. Maybe he should ask the FBI. Who is this Guccifer 2.0 persona? We still don't know who Guccifer is, but we do know that he's a fraud. Now, how do we know that? Our Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity group is blessed with all kinds of expertise, including two former technical directors of the National Security Agency, Bill Binney and Ed Loomis. And they know that Guccifer is an entity that is fabricated. They know because they have some forensics that come out of metadata, and we can prove it. We have hard copy of the intrusions, and Bill Binney has taken me through, so even a liberal arts guy like me can understand. So what does that mean? Well, that means that these indictments of the 12 GRU people, GRU, the military intelligence arm of the Russians, well, they're all based on Guccifer 2.0. Hello? What does that mean? It means that, as my Russian teacher would say, it means that you cannot be sure of these conclusions. It means that Bob Mueller, well, Bob Mueller enjoys a reputation of being universally respected. That is, if you read the New York Times or the Washington Post. Now, Colleen Rowley, who worked in the FBI during his tenure and worked when James Comey was in the Department of Justice, tells us all that, you know, Bob Mueller falsified the intelligence before Iraq, didn't say no to the torture, approved the wiretapping, you know, that famous scene in the hospital. Well, the next day they approved the program, they just changed the name, okay? I had a personal encounter with Bob Mueller. I was at Georgetown University with 300 other people, and John Brennan introduced his old friend, Bob Mueller, who had just retired from the FBI, and Mueller made some comments. Any questions? So I raised my hand. Okay, I do that, you know. So I said, now, Mr. Mueller, as a lawyer, do you have any legal qualms with the process whereby you take sensitive information? It's called parallel construction. And for the benefit of people there, I said, that means that you take illegally acquired information from NSA, you give it to the cops, and you say, look, go to this corner next Saturday night, this time, and you get these guys, you prosecute them, and you put them in jail. You don't tell the judge. You don't tell the defense attorney where you got the information originally. And so you're perjury is involved at every stage of this. And I was just wondering, Mr. Mueller, do you have any legal qualms about that? You know, there's a lot of murmuring. My all intelligence friends there. So Mueller looks at me. He's a big guy. He looks at Mr. McGovern. He said, after 9/11, we were given special authorities. Next question. There you go, folks. After 9/11, we were given special authorities. You know, you've heard endless times, you know, after 9/11, maybe you could complete the sentence. After 9/11, everything changed, right? And so this Constitution, you know, that I swore to support and defend, it was sort of overtaken by 9/11. My God. And he was the head of the FBI at the time, okay? So that's Mueller. Now, how did he get appointed? Well, you probably remember that when James Comey decided he would leak a personal conversation with the president. Now, in my day, a personal conversation with the president was ipso facto classified. I mean, hello, that's a no-brainer. But he thought, well, he could make it unclassified. He gave it to a lawyer friend. They leaked it to the New York Times. And the story was that President Trump tried to get Comey to go easy on General Flynn. Ah, so New York Times publishes that. Now, they asked James Comey, you know, it's a little irregular for FBI heads, present or former, to leak information. Why did you do that? And he said, oh, I wanted a special prosecutor named. And sure enough, the next day, a special prosecutor was named. His name was Bob Mueller. And James Comey said, thank you, Jesus. My best friend forever, Bob Mueller. Oh, man, this is going to be great. Hello. That's how it happened, folks. Don't believe me. Believe what James Comey said. Now, with respect to Comey, while we're on the subject, when it was claimed that the Russians hacked into the DNC, into the Democratic National Committee. Do you remember what John McCain said? Act of war. It's an act of war. The Russians have done an act of war. What did James Comey do, the head of the FBI? Anybody know? It was like the tar baby in Uncle Remus. You didn't say nothing. Didn't do nothing. Now, if you were the head of the FBI, and you heard that the Russians had hacked into the DNC computers, what was the first thing you would do? Yeah, right. Seize the computers. Take a look at them. Send your forensic experts in there to seize the computers and find out what, you know, how did this all happen? But for some reason or other, Comey didn't do that. And when he was asked softball questions by the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is a softball, the archetype of a softball outfit. Now, Mr. Comey, tell me, you didn't have access to the computers of the DNC. Why was that? Oh, we were never given access. We were never given. Well, hello? What do you need? All you need is a little warrant or a little letter. You know, the FBI doesn't hesitate from invading the homes of some of my NSA friends or anything. So he said, we weren't given access. Next question. Now, Mr. Comey, is it general practice not to seize the computers in such a case, like when people are saying there's a war? Well, no. I have to admit that best practices would mean that we had physical access to the computers, but we decided to rely on CrowdStrike, which was a super top-rate cyber organization, and they did forensics, and we borrowed their forensics. Anybody know about CrowdStrike? Run by a bunch of Russian-hating groups, hired by Hillary Clinton, and with a very spotty record, actually a disastrous record of veracity in their conclusions in the past. So for some reason or other, James Comey didn't do that. Well, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. Let me be a little bit more orderly here. So we have June 12th. Assange says he's got the emails. Now, July 25th, when the DNC convention was, now, just imagine the situation at the DNC. Hillary sitting there with a bunch of her advisors, and they're saying, oh, my God, Assange just got DNC emails or my emails. Oh, and we haven't even had our convention yet. What is Bernie going to say? What is Bernie going to say when he finds out what we did? My God, what are we going to do? And somebody says, I know what we do. We'll blame the Russians. Everybody's like, come on. It was the Russians. It was WikiLeaks. It's okay. We get a twofer here. We hate WikiLeaks as much as the Russians. We'll say that the Russians hacked and they gave the information to WikiLeaks. Anybody got any better ideas? Okay, we'll go with it. That was it, folks. That's what they did starting after June 15th, all the way up to when, 3 days before the convention, Julian Assange released the emails. Now, what happened? What was the headline in New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, when it became clear that these hacked emails had been published by WikiLeaks? Headlines were, why did Russia do this? Why are the Russians doing this? Nobody looked at the content of the emails. It was a magnificent diversion of attention. You look at the record. Nobody looked at what the emails said. It was all about, why did the Russians do this? So it worked like a charm. And I had a chance to hear Jennifer Palmieri, who was Hillary Clinton's PR person, and she was bragging about going to the convention and going around in a golf cart to the various cable and other news outlets and pushing this line under instruction that the Russians hacked. She said, and I have it there, it's on tape, C-SPAN has it. She said, you know, it was hard for me to believe the Russians would hack to help defeat Hillary Clinton, help Trump win, but we tried to sell it. And it was hard for anyone to believe, but when we got back to Brooklyn was Clinton headquarters, right? Then intelligence people started coming to us and filling in the blanks as to how the Russians hacked. And then we had journalists who had been briefed by intelligence people, and they told us more. And then, best of all, the Obama administration would start to confirm these stories. So then we were off and running with this story. Now, It was so bad. John Brennan, the head of the CIA, was leaking like a sieve to the New York Times and elsewhere. It was so bad that the Wall Street Journal complained. They're not talking to us. They only talk to the Washington Post. They only talk to the New York Times. They're neglecting us. That's the Wall Street Journal saying. So that's what was going on then, okay? So the story was out, and it was clear in everybody's mind. Okay. Then there's the election. What was it, the 8th of November? And then a curious thing happened. Now, we all watch Rachel Maddow, of course, right? No, okay. Well, she had Chuck Schumer as a special guest on the 3rd of January. And they were talking about Trump and how he was bad-mouthing the intelligence community. Can you imagine bad-mouthing his own intelligence community? And so Chuck Schumer said, you know, I thought that Trump was a pretty smart businessman, and he knew, you know, what fights to pick, but he's done something very, very stupid. And Rachel says, oh, what would that be, Chuck? And he says, well, he says he's taken on the intelligence community. And they have 6 ways to Sunday to get back at you. Very foolish thing to do. Now, Rachel, if she was a real interviewer, she would have said, Senator, are you saying that the President of the United States or the President-elect should be afraid of the intelligence community? And that's, of course, exactly what he was saying. And I'm sorry to tell you that's true, because that is the reality. Trump's own freedom of flexibility, his freedom to do things he wants, is tightly circumscribed by the intelligence community. And that is the Donnybrook that's in process right now. I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a few minutes. Anyhow, that was Chuck Schumer on the 3rd of January. Now, on the 5th of January, President Obama, in his last few weeks in office, this is 17 now, 2017, he was briefed by NSA, CIA, and the FBI that had done this very poor excuse for an intelligence assessment, adducing no real evidence, but saying that Putin himself had ordered the hacking of the DNC. Now, he was briefed on that. Now, what's really interesting is that this document that everybody crows about, this intelligence community assessment, the only accurate word in those three words is assessment. Was it the intelligence community? No. Was it just three agencies of the intelligence community? No. What was it? It was hand-picked analysts from these three agencies, not the agencies themselves, hand-picked analysts. Who picked them? Who picked them? James Comey, for God's sake. Now, everyone knows in Washington that if you handpick the analysts, you handpick the conclusions, right? Okay. So there you had this document out that everyone is still crowing about. How can Trump stand next to Putin and not believe U.S. intelligence? You know, this is terrible, you know. Oh, U.S. intelligence is always correct, except for before Iraq and except for a couple other things, all right? So this is necessary because on the 18th, so we're talking about the 5th of January, 2017, Obama's briefed on all this, okay? Now, on the 18th, Obama gets up for his last press conference. And having read this and been briefed on this assessment that Putin himself directed that the DNC be hacked and the results be given to WikiLeaks, what does Obama say? He says, and I quote, "The conclusions of the intelligence community with respect to how Russian hacking got to WikiLeaks are inconclusive," period, end quote. Inconclusive conclusions. Wow. So why does Obama say that 2 days before he's going out of office? Because he's a lawyer. He wants to protect his derriere, you know? The Russian hacking was bad enough, because he knew probably knew what the evidence was, like not much, but saying that it was given by the Russians to WikiLeaks. You know, we know, and I refer to my NSA colleagues, former NSA, two of them were technical directors at NSA. They know that it wasn't a hack because of the fact, number one, NSA collects everything. When Bill Binney, former technical director, when he told me that, he says, Ray, trust me. I couldn't say this before, but once Ed Snowden brought those slides out into Hong Kong, not only could I say it, but I could show exactly how it's done. I could show the trace routes that are implanted in the network where they trace every single email. It's broken down into packets. The packets are reassembled. Those of you technical people realize what that means. We can trace exactly where it originated or where it ended up. And there ain't nothing. There ain't nothing on Russian hacking. So that's negative evidence, right? In other words, the argument would be, if NSA had that, certainly they would reveal that given all the controversy. But, you know, Donald Rumsfeld, not my favorite philosopher, but he did go to Princeton, and he learned the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
You heard the first of a two-part program with Ray McGovern on debunking Russiagate. He was recorded by KODX LPFM on August 4, 2018 at the Common Good Cafe in Seattle, Washington. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelaudin. Thank you for listening.
To Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
And on a bigger level, I think we need to look at the kind of global role that countries like the United States and Canada play and how our foreign policies contribute to displacing people and pushing them into the migrant stream.
That's the voice of Dr. Aviva Chomsky. On this week's edition of Latin Waves, we speak to Dr. Chomsky about her book, They Take Our Jobs, and 20 Other Myths About Immigration. Stay tuned.
Dr. Aviva Chomsky has written extensively on the kinds of rights that are denied to many immigrants. In her wonderful book, she dismantles 21 of the most widespread myths and beliefs about immigrants and immigration. Her book is titled, They Take Our Jobs. We're very privileged to have Dr. Aviva Chomsky on our show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
Now, you've written extensively not just on the causes of immigration, what causes people to move from a place where they belong, where they are respected and where they have roots, to places where they're invisible. Let's begin there. Let's talk a little bit about the social and economic conditions that drive people from their homelands and most things they care about.
Well, Juan Gonzalez wrote a great book a couple of years ago called Harvest of Empire. And in his title, he expresses his argument that immigration is the harvest of empire. That is, the conditions that if you look at the global flows of migration in the world today, there's a really clear flow from former colonies into former colonial powers. So you have immigrants coming into the United States from places like Mexico, from Southeast Asia, other parts of the Caribbean, Central America, South America. You see immigrants going into France from Algeria. You see immigrants going into England from India and Pakistan. That the colonial relationship in lots of different ways sets the stage for later migrations. One of the ways it sets the stage is impoverishing the colony and enriching the colonial power. So you see the flow of resources out of the colony into the colonial power, and you see cultural ties set up. And, of course, you see people from the colonial power going into the colony, that is, the British in India or the Americans, U.S. Americans going into Mexico, never stopped to ask for visas. They just invaded and took over. So those ties are set up by, in a sense, the free movement of people. And then the colonial powers clamp down and say, oh, but wait a minute, we can't have that movement going the other way. We're allowed to go everywhere, but they have to stay in these prisons that we created for them.
Immigrants are being used to scapegoat some of the issues the government is having with relation to a downturn economy. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between the loss and the criminalization that enables the not only the oppression but the dehumanizing treatment that many of these workers receive?
Yeah, I'm actually working on a new book right now, and I was writing earlier this morning, and I was thinking about the question, you know, what part of illegal don't you understand? And thinking, actually, people don't understand anything about the term illegal, and I'd rather turn back and ask those people, well, what part of illegal do you understand? Like, you really have no idea what you're talking about. You were saying something about naturalizing oppression and naturalizing this category of illegal as if it was something clear-cut and natural, that we should divide people up into sort of caste-like categories and label some of them legal and some of them illegal, is actually quite a bizarre thing for human beings to do if you really step back and think about it. Clearly, maintaining a portion of the United States population without full civil rights has been true in the United States ever since the United States has come into being. And using that portion of the population that's maintained without full civil rights to do the dirtiest work of society has also been a constant in U.S. history. Today, we use this unnatural concept of illegal to justify keeping a portion of the population in the kind of conditions that's going to force them to do underpaid labor that basically sustains the standard of living of the rest of us. There's certainly nothing just or natural about it. And then on top of that, they get scapegoated. That is, the idea that immigrants are harming the economy then just serves to justify further exploitation of immigrants.
I want to talk a little bit about the myths that allow us to almost make this oppression of people invisible. This, you know, injustice is everywhere, is all around us. And yet it's almost as if you can't see it because it's so inbred and ingrained in our societal norms. So let's talk a little bit about some of the myths. In your book, you titled They Take Our Jobs. Talk about the relationship between this idea that immigrants are actually a burden on the local economy. They're a burden on our countries, and that they take rather than contribute.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, that's one of the most upside-down myths at all when you actually look at the impact of immigrants on the economy, because immigrants are, in fact, working at the very worst jobs in the economy, using very little in the way of social services and paying far more than their share of taxes. So they're contributing their underpaid labor and they're also contributing their taxes, and they're really getting practically nothing back from the society for what they pay into it because they're not eligible for most social services that citizens are eligible for. The phrase immigrants take American jobs is thrown around so much. It's one of those things almost like if you hear it enough times, it's going to become true. First of all, we live in a global economy, and we've lived in a global economy for many, many years. And if you want to look at some of the different factors that have affected unemployment rates in this country, one of the biggest ones has been the shift of manufacturing abroad. That is, jobs lost in the manufacturing sector because companies have decided that they could make greater profits by evading things like U.S. minimum wage law and environmental protections and health and safety protections in the United States and shifting their production somewhere else. That's one big cause of unemployment. Another big cause of unemployment in the United States is government cutbacks, where people in almost every level of government services, from teachers to social workers, federal, state, and local employees, are losing their jobs because of government cutbacks. Neither of those has anything to do with immigration. And in fact, immigrants tend to fill the job sectors that nobody who has a choice would choose to do. And I'll just give you one example. I'm not sure if this is also the case in California, but certainly in Massachusetts, if you get a daily newspaper delivered, it's very likely delivered by an undocumented immigrant. Newspaper delivery is one of the worst jobs you can practically imagine. You have to get up at 2:30 in the morning and work from 2:30 in the morning till 7:30 in the morning. It's pretty much all done out of your car. You're driving, and it's basically the most difficult manual labor, jumping in and out of your car to put people's newspapers where they want them for 3 or 4 hours every morning. And, of course, it's an expensive job to have because you have to maintain a car and maintain insurance and all of those things. And it's a very, very low-paid job. And on top of that, I don't know if you follow the weather reports on the East Coast, but we've had a series of blizzards this winter that have basically shut down the entire state. And the governor declares a state of emergency and says that everybody should stay in their houses. People should not go out on the street because of the snowplows. Most people's workplaces either close or tell them to come in late or to use their judgment about whether it's safe to be on the road, whether to go into work or not. But the newspaper delivery companies tell their employees that they had better find a way to be there and get all those papers delivered or they're going to lose their roots. This is the kind of job that we're talking about when we say that jobs that Americans don't want are the sectors that immigrants are forced into and can't really protest about their working conditions because of their undocumented status.
I want to also bring another concept that I think has become very popular, and that is the idea of cuts. The common use of the immigrant as the scapegoat for social cuts. They become a burden because they don't pay taxes. They're illegally, so they're not contributing their share. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how this willfulness to create a dual society, both in Canada and the U.S., where you have a large number of people as undocumented and the rest of the population, being able to shift the guilt of government's lack of investment or poor judgment in deregulating banking, reducing taxes for the rich, has created a much larger burden on the middle class, the working class of this country, where that blame is now placed on the most insecure and most vulnerable citizens. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the laws that have gone to not only criminalize the victims of these policies, but also the way in which the society as a whole almost is unable to see them as equals.
Well, in terms of the laws, I think most people really became aware of the legal situation when Arizona passed SB 1070. And a lot of people were outraged at SB 1070, but didn't really realize how much of SB 1070 has already been put into effect through federal law, especially through the 287G program, which trains local police to essentially become enforcers of immigration law. 287G is a voluntary program, but it's a federal program that invites local law enforcement agencies at either the city, county, or state level to collaborate with ICE by going through a training and basically empowering themselves as enforcers of immigration law, which is pretty much what SB 1070 tried to do, and the secure communities, which forces local law enforcement agencies to also become enforcers, essentially become enforcers of immigration law by forcing them to share all information with ICE. That is, it puts ICE everywhere so that if you're stopped for a traffic violation, your data is going over to ICE. Now, local law enforcement agencies in general have been very opposed to these kinds of laws and programs. They've often been forced into them by mayors and city councils and sheriffs. But the police enforcers on the ground hate these programs because their job is policing the communities that they work in, and they need to maintain good relations with the people in the communities. Their job is protecting the population. And if people are afraid of being turned into immigration, they're going to evade the police, and it ruins the ability of the police to act locally. And yet, 287G has been implemented nationwide, and Secure Communities is in the process of being implemented nationwide. So the legislative situation is actually very grim.
You know, many of these laws also help or create an ability for the average citizen to legitimize the injustice that are committed against immigrants and the oppression and repression that they are victims of.
Underlying a lot of the sort of right-wing populist appeal of these laws is something you mentioned earlier, the idea that, well, immigrants aren't contributing, so we have to save ourselves by punishing immigrants and getting rid of immigrants. And that leads to another one of the myths that I talk about in the book, which is that immigrants don't pay taxes. In fact, the vast majority of immigrants pay taxes. In fact, all immigrants pay taxes of one sort or another, because it's impossible to engage in any economic transaction in this country without paying taxes. You know, paying rent, buying a house, buying gas, buying a car, buying food. Any economic transaction is going to be taxed in one way or another. But most immigrants also pay payroll taxes. That is, either by using a TIN, a taxpayer identification number, or by using a false Social Security number, people who are undocumented, most of them, in fact, do pay taxes. They pay into the system, and we see this especially in the case of Social Security, where if you use a false Social Security number, the taxes are deducted from your paycheck. Your Social Security and other taxes are deducted, but you have no actual account with Social Security because your name doesn't match the number. So Social Security Administration takes the money, and it's kept in what they call a suspension file, which currently takes in about $7 billion a year from people who are paying into Social Security but are never going to be able to collect because their name doesn't match the Social Security number that they were using. So that $7 billion a year is basically subsidizing the Social Security system for all of the rest of us who have valid Social Security numbers. So that's just one of the ways in which the contribution that immigrants are making is so disproportionate, and yet the government uses them as an excuse to try to explain the economic suffering that's going on in the middle classes.
In your book, you're very good at pointing out one of the most important myths, and that is in Canada, we call ourselves a multicultural society. In the U.S., the myth is that the United States is a melting pot that has always welcomed immigrants from all over the world. And I wonder if you could talk about the racial discrimination that is part and is so ingrained in immigration policies, but the most of us fail to see because we've been told that we live in a colorblind society, that, you know, we welcome everybody. They just have to come to the right roots. Is there a cue for everybody? In my opinion, there seems some people don't have a cue.
You know, it's always seemed kind of ironic to me in the United States how many, many white people say, well, my ancestors came here legally, and as if this is something that they're very proud of. But if you look at the history of U.S. immigration law, the reason their ancestors came here legally is there were no restrictions on white immigration. There were only restrictions on immigration of people of color. And in fact, during the first 100 years of this country's history, the restrictions were not restrictions on immigration. They were restrictions on citizenship of people of color. So as long as there were restrictions on citizenship, where people of color could not be citizens of the United States, there was not only free immigration of people of color, there was forced immigration of people of color through the slave trade. And that was all legal. But it's not necessarily something to be proud of, that the law has always favored people of your race and that your ancestors were able to take advantage of unfair laws that favored people of their race. It's not necessarily something to be ashamed of either. That is, we can't control what the laws were 100 years ago, but we shouldn't go around bragging about the fact that we were able to benefit from unfair advantages, or that our ancestors were. Is there a line? People always say, well, why don't they get in line and wait? Well, the reason they don't get in line and wait is that there is no line. And I think that that's something that people really don't understand. That is, if you come from a European country, there's a line. If you come from Mexico, there's a line for some people, but for most people, there is no line. And that's something that I think people really need to grapple with, that there is no line. People are being forced by U.S. economic policies in Mexico out of their subsistence lives and into the immigrant stream, and then they're told there is no line. The only way you can survive and feed your family is by immigrating, but there's no line to get in to do it.
In your book, you point out that there is a problem with immigration, but it's not the immigrants that are the problem. So what can a society who is intent on creating a more inclusive and a more humane society where we recognize the inherent value of every human life do to make our country's immigration policies reflective of that?
Well, I think there's two things we can do. And one has to do with domestic policies and immigration policies. And I think, you know, both in the United States and Canada, we hold on to this myth that we believe that people should be treated equally and that there shouldn't be discrimination against any group of people. We should make that a reality. That is, we really should treat people equally regardless of immigration status as well as regardless of any other status. And we really shouldn't discriminate against anybody for any reason, including the immigration status. I think we need to change our immigration policies and laws so that they don't discriminate against people who are trying to come into our countries. And on a bigger level, I think we need to look at the kind of global role that countries like the United States and Canada play and how our foreign policies contribute to displacing people and pushing them into the migrant stream. And when I say, is immigration a problem? For most people who are forced to migrate, immigration is a huge problem. They're forced to, as you said at the very beginning, leave their friends and families and communities and to go to a place where they're not welcome, where they may not know anybody, where they're discriminated against. This is a huge problem. Most people who migrate would rather stay home if they could. And it's the global economic system, basically under the control of countries like the United States and Canada, that creates the economic circumstances that force people to migrate.
Thank you so much for being with us. You've written many books. You have an upcoming book as well. Tell us about it.
Yeah. The Cuba book is called A History of the Cuban Revolution. And it came about because I've been teaching the Cuban Revolution for many years and taking students to Cuba while it was still allowed. And one little piece of good news is that it's now allowed again, educational travel to Cuba. Obama did manage to do one good thing in terms of foreign policy and has reopened educational travel to Cuba. But I really haven't found the right book to use in my Cuba classes. I like to use books that are really accessible and that really get into these kinds of myths. And in a way, the immigration book and the concept of the myths was really with me when I was writing the Cuba book, because certainly American students hold a lot of myths about Cuba. So although the book isn't explicitly organized around myths, it's definitely that concept is in there. Mm-hmm. So it's a very brief college-level text on the history of the Cuban Revolution that tries to give an introduction that breaks those myths that so many people in this country have about Cuba.
Thank you so much. Dr. Aviva Chomsky is a professor of history and coordinator of Latin American Studies at Salem State College. She is the author of several books. And how can people access your books?
Well, the immigration book is published by Beacon Press, so you can get it straight off the Beacon Press website, or you can get it from any online bookseller or have your bookstore, local bookstore, order it. The Cuba book is also published by Wiley Blackwell. And it's available direct from them or from any bookseller.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thanks so much for the chance to talk to you.
Take care.
Before I put on the final song, I want to reiterate that immigrants and other workers become scapegoats for those in power, whose economic policies have failed the majority of people. I discovered a new term this week which explains this behavior. It's called horizontal violence, which is defined as harmful behavior via attitudes, actions, and words and other behaviors that is directed towards us by another colleague. In short, the recession was not caused by the working class or undocumented workers, but the deindustrialization of the country, offshoring of jobs and the destruction of a livable wage, and the speculative trading by bankers and other insiders. Let's focus on the real culprits of this recession. Let's adopt a new term called called vertical violence and point our anger where it belongs. Thanks for listening this week. Bye for now.
We're not being taught to deal with the world as it is. We're being taught to deal with this fairyland, which we're not even living in anymore. It's sad, because I'm telling you, and it should not be me telling you.
But whatever he thinks is right, he's from Texas, he's got to be right.
Bueno, y vamos con el tema de esta noche.
The language they speak in Latin America is Latin, true or false.
What? Abro mi boca, ojos cerrados y el mundo color boca. Tantas veces me he sentido solo, mano en boca. Mi indigestión, nueva gestión de mi tiempo. Esto es mi testamento, yo me voy, llamo, lo siento. Arreglando mi crisis, apocalipsis interior. Mi chiquita, fin del mundo, paso sin temor. Ya se murió mi mala suerte, mi nube negra. Pon una nube de leche en mi café, nena. Azúcar también, palabras cruzan también. Por eso duermo bien si por lo menos toco a alguien. Imbécil, mi tesis es la historia de un cambio de energía que me trae gloria. Sigue mi filosofía hasta que me muera. Mi lucha es mi arte como un baile de capoeira. Fuera del tema de la vida no queda nada. Pana, mata el miedo y quédate firme como zapata. Al ritmo del palo vi de la lata. El sol aparece, alquimia personal, no es nada fatal. Por eso te lo digo, arriba este instrumental. No mare que va a ser. My rib cage is filled with magnetic fuel. 12 jewels, dudes to serve fools. Reach like a telephone. Weeks have been alone and kinda laugh in my zone so I can write this few songs. The school of life is my home. I'm roaming like a home. A bump is sickening stuff, supporting beer bottle. It seems like the dust can never settle in the street. Rich is always in need, just like a mouth to feed. A melted pot with beats to get along. Acting fake like silicone. All your layers defective, it's time to say a prayer. Don't count on your mayor. It's all human behavior. The words are planted, that we can make a difference. My appeal, schizophrenic topic, switching like split personality. My alter ego, just satisfy my need to change. We form from a worm, form the butterfly. Who need no alibi to justify this pride?
Injustice keeps a flood in the streets. Our acts, our homes, well, prophecy to
question va poser. Combien dirigeants ton cerveau paralysé, brisé, couillon esquelette pulvérisé. Quelqu'un y'a premier utilité, y'a tête qui poisée. Pitché, y'a tout bien haut pour qu'arriver. Y'a mon réussi, son projet réalisé. Y'a bête de moins, son tête de plus en vérité, son bénéfice. Souffle les sorties sous l'ombre et son fond sacrifice. Mais qu'il y a Jimmy's, car j'ai tout Jimmy's. Y'a putain, j'ai passé n'importe quel virus. Ta vie m'a dit, faut voir, j'y positif, et y'a Jimmy's. Et tes proches, y'a compagnons qui construit, nous pour chef, pour créatif, même j'avais le crève, change en vie, paye ou bien, mais fais tout ton connaît pour pas quitter le très bien. Ton courage de mon pas pour me y'en faire.
Injustice keeps a flood in the streets, our rats, our homes, our property leases.
Fue el que empezó a atacar verbalmente a todos los periodistas, a los camarógrafos, y fue el que dio inicio a la trifulca.
That was the incredible lyrics and music of Pneumatic Massive and their song title, Say the Least. For information on their music, you can go to pneumaticmassive.org. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.